Thanks, Rob. 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Download with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Woo! Wow. Nobody on the street. This is one for the ages, as the newspapers say. I said, I'm Justin Kaufman. We have a huge show for you tonight. You know, there was this thought about, well, you know, the game's on. It's the World Series. It's the Chicago Cubs. It's the first time in 71 years. Maybe we should counter-program. You know, maybe we should just talk about, you know, the symphony. 4 hours of the symphony. But we're not going to do that tonight. Instead, we have been busy at work. We wanted to bring some great Chicago stories to you from great Chicagoans who are involved with Cubs culture. And that's what we're doing tonight. I'm excited to say that coming up right here after the news, we're going to talk with Hall of Fame pitcher, good old number 31, not that 31, the better 31, Ferguson Jenkins. Fergie Jenkins will join us to talk about 1969, what they couldn't accomplish then, and how this experience, this emotion, how he's become sort of a vessel to almost represent the people who are not with us any longer, whether it be Ron Santo or Ernie Banks, the others on that team that aren't here. So Fergie Jenkins is going to join us coming up right after the news here. That's awesome. Also tonight, it's 39 years since the great groundbreaking, I don't even know what, I was going to say improvised play, but I guess that's right. Bleacher Bums. The Organic Theater right here in on Clark Street, also back in the day in Uptown, 1977, decided to write a play about bleacher culture. That's right. The famed Bleacher Bums that were beginning national notoriety at the time. So they went down to the bleachers and they spent some time and they wrote a play. Now, the Organic Theater at the time, the ensemble was Joe Mantegna, Dennis Franz, Stuart Gordon. Later actors were Dennis Farina. You had Joel Murray was in it at one point. And really an iconic, if not the iconic, Chicago play. Joe Mantegna and Stuart Gordon going to join us tonight to talk about their their memories of Bleacher Bums and how they're feeling as the Cubs kick off here in the World Series. Also tonight, former Chicago Cub general manager, the most winningest coach, or I'm sorry, general manager in Cubs history, Jim Hendry is going to join us. Jim Hendry was, the playoff appearances are 2003, 2007, 2008 with him. He also, I mean, I could say is also involved in the 1998 team, but he was not the general manager at that time. But he was with the organization since 1995. He was, of course, removed when Theo Epstein came in 2012. Jim Hendry is responsible for two huge players that will make impact in this World Series. One, Javier Baez, who plays second base, and catcher Wilson Contreras. They were drafted by Jim Hendry's organization at the time, and he signed them before he left. So we will talk with Jim Hendry coming up in the 8 o'clock hour as well. Non-baseball stuff, well, we got a ton to talk about as well. Mark Kelly's going to join us. Mark Kelly is the new Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events Commissioner for the City of Chicago. Big sort of, I guess, committee hearing at City Council this week in which some of the aldermen said, you know what, let's really get into festivals. Of course, Chicago, huge festival town. But the aldermen want to know, with all the budget crisis and things around, are we a city that should still be providing free festivals? We're talking Blues Fest, Jazz Fest, Taste of Chicago. Mark Kelly kind of danced around the topic. We'll talk to him tonight about that and whether or not it is time that Chicago starts thinking differently about providing free cultural cultural festivals and events and shows and things of that nature. But also talk to him about the future of arts and culture in this town. Rahm Emanuel this week said that 2017 will be known as the year of public art. It's giving money to all the different aldermen and neighborhoods to essentially spruce up the neighborhoods of Chicago with public art. So we'll talk with Mark Kelly about that. Also, 100 years of Navy Pier. Jeffrey Bear, a good buddy who comes on the program regularly, he's got a new documentary, a special for WTTW, and he's going to join us to talk about the history of Navy Pier, and it doesn't have a lot to do with the Navy. So, yeah. So that's coming up as well. And, of course, like I said, coming up in the 10 o'clock hour, we will have post-game. Mark Carman, Adam Hogue, Andy Mazur, all the team. Kevin Powell out in Cleveland. We will be giving you the True Blue Playoff Plus programming here on the download. Pete Zimmerman, I haven't had a chance to talk to you fully about your experience this weekend. You were at the game, the clinching game on Saturday. How are you feeling right now as the Cubs get underway for the World Series?
I am very excited and very confident.
Are you is nervous gone? Is the nerves gone? Is
the
all
nerves
that
are
all
completely
gone, right?
Yeah. And I'm just sitting back, relaxed, enjoying this. I want them to win, of course, but got over the hump on Saturday.
So the curse and everything that goes into the Chicago Cubs lore, that has so much more to do with getting to the World Series because there's so many trip-ups and black cats and curses and things of that nature that stop the team from getting to the World Series.
Yeah, like this is proven that they're not going to collapse. They're going to get there.
Right.
They have a team that is good enough to get there.
And so, okay. And so on. You sent me a picture asking if, you know, if I needed any Taco Bell on Saturday night because you were standing in the 10,000 plus people that were on Clark and Addison. How was that experience?
I tried to avoid all that. You know,
you weren't a guy who jumped right in, took the shirt off.
No, didn't climb any poles.
Yeah. Kept your clothes on.
We were leaving. Our seats are in the upper deck, and we were, like, going down the stadium, you know. And people were, like, looking outside. I'm like, what are they looking outside at? And we went down another level, and there's another level of people just, like, staring, like, you couldn't even, like, 10 deep of people looking outside the chain link fence.
Staring at what's happening in the corner.
So then we finally, like, there was an opening. So I looked in and, yeah, like, Clark, Waveland, or I guess it would be Clark and Sheffield.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, like, thousands and thousands of people. And then I started worrying. I'm like,
How am
I going to get out of here?
It was like, I am legend.
Yeah.
How do I get off the island?
Right. And you couldn't get out the main entrance. They'd closed the main entrance to Wrigley Field. You can get out on the left field side or the right field side. So we walked all the way down to the left field side. And we walked out, and there's tons of people outside. And then we just kind of walked down Seminary, a little side street. There was, you know, a few stragglers. Mm-hmm. And then we just, like, walked to the next stop of the Red Line and Sheridan. And, like, nobody was there. It was all confined to, like, right – like, billions of people right around the stadium.
You would think of all of the Chicago Cubs fans who know Wrigleyville so well that they could spread out and be like, I know spot at Seminary we can party.
Right,
instead, they're
exactly.
Like, no, it's got to be Addison and Clark. It's got to be right there.
Which, I mean, I understand. That's
hey,
you
guys,
know.
Let's go to Pine Grove. Come with me. We'll walk a
Yeah.
I know a place on Newport. Come on. Yeah, none of that. They just all had to be at Addison and Clark.
Well, I mean, I know you kind of bear witness to some of this as you're kind of looking for places to perhaps go this weekend to watch the games. And
we'll talk about that.
It seems like it's impossible to be anywhere near the stadium to watch any of these games.
Without being gouged. I mean, that's the issue. I mean, you could go, but there's, you know, the bars are not stupid. And part of it, and I don't want to get into this because I want to get to Fergie Jenkins, but you know, there is this sort of way that, you know, the Cubs are really about this collaborative spirit. Everybody's together. Hey, can we sing the song together? Yet you have a lot of, I don't want to say the P word, predators around that are like, this is our chance to cash in. This is our chance to make some money. And the bars on Clark Street, who really aren't of the lore and the legend of the Clark Street bars from 1985 or the Bleacher Bum days. These are brand new bars, and they're like, it is cash time. They are gouging. I mean, the reports coming in about cover charges and what it's going to take to actually watch the game when it's at Wrigley Field over the weekend is astounding. We'll talk more about that coming up. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by my man Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. Coming up, we'll take a break. Fergie Jenkins, stay with us.
The mad Russian took his leave, then Cavaretta led the team. Ernie's baseball days were full of fun. Williams began his streak, and Fergie was at his peak. Wrigley Field had many moments in the sun. I'm talking baseball. Glenn Beckett and the Andy Cubs. Baseball. Kessinger and Randy. Santo and the Vulture on the club. Handsome Ransom, DeFondi, Kenny Hubbs. Talking baseball. Baseball and the Cubs.
Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest, he doesn't need a huge introduction because he's only a Hall of Famer and the best pitcher in Cubs history. Ferguson Jenkins joins us on the line right now. Mr. Jenkins, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Hey, Justin, I appreciate it. Thanks.
So talk about this. What does it mean for you to be a Hall of Fame Chicago Cub, to have your number up on the foul pole? What does it mean for you that the Cubs are in the World Series?
Well, it's pretty dramatic because of the fact that I played in the organization for 10 years and then coached for them also. I mean, these young men have really, really did a good job. And I think it's admirable that they get this kind of reward because they played so well, winning over 100 games during the season and having to play the wild card and then playoffs and having to prove themselves, you know, week after week. And now I think the task is almost over because they got a good opportunity to be World Series winners.
For you, I mean, what does it mean for you to put on that jersey and to play and to be a part of teams like the 1969 Cubs where, you know, everyone was thinking that was a year and it didn't happen? What's it mean for you to see this team get over the hump?
Well, you know, they've had so many good ball clubs over the years. The 69-70 team, 84, 2003, 2008. I just think that the pride of having to have played in the Cub uniform. You know, I played for the Wrigley family, and now there's been so many different owners. You know, now you got Tom Ricketts, which is an outstanding owner, and these players are really playing well. So I'm pretty proud of the fact that I was a Chicago Cub for those many years.
You know, for you, I mean, being one of the, if not the biggest pitcher with, I mean, the stats are enormous, are overwhelming, what you did not only in the 60s, but the early 70s with winning 24 games for the Cubs. When you see, you know, the Cubs staff and what they can do now, when you see guys like John Lester and you see Jake Arrieta and Kyle Hendricks, do you wish you were in situations like that as a ball player? Do you wish that you had a chance to be on the mound for a game one of a World Series?
Oh, yeah. So well, there's always an opportunity that when you look back, maybe not born too early, but we were right there. We just didn't get over the hump. And I'm pretty proud of these young men that are playing now. You know, Lester, Hendricks, as you said, Arrieta. I mean, they got a good ball club. They've got a good team that scores runs. They play good defense, and they have a great pitching staff. So, I mean, it's all about these young men that are playing now. I think they're doing a fabulous job.
Talking with Fergie Jenkins, the Hall of Fame pitcher for the Chicago Cubs here on the Download 720 WGN. I'm interested in your relationship with the Cubs fans. The fans, of course, you know, there's been so much made this week about getting to the World Series and sort of the idea of all these fans for the first time in 71 years being able to experience that. What's your relationship like with Chicago Cubs fandom?
They've waited a long time. I know they're pretty proud, too. These people that go out there year after year and buy season tickets and watch the Cubs, and now they've got that opportunity to cheer for a pennant-winning ball club and then possibly a World Series team that could do it in the next week or so. But I'm just happy that they've had that opportunity and they're executing it and they're doing it the right way. And if things work out, they score enough runs, pitch well enough, they could be World Series winners.
Yeah, how about that? You know, when you think back to, you know, especially what we just saw in the end of the NLCS in Chicago at Wrigley Field, clinching that game and watching, you know, Wrigleyville explode and all the thousands of people that came down for this. What's the emotions that run through your body, through your head as a former Chicago Cub, a Hall of Fame Chicago Cub, when you see that kind of celebration?
Well, I watched it. 10,000 people in the street, not leaving after the game was over. And Hendricks pitched a fabulous ball game. I just think that they are as proud as the players are. And these fans are waiting for the ultimate goal, and that's a World Series winner. And so I'm pretty proud of the fact that I was watching them do that, the way they played, watching the fans stay and celebrate with the players. I think it's pretty admirable.
For you, I mean, you represent a team, 1969, that was the team of record for the Chicago Cubs for so many years. Even though nothing, you know, they didn't get a chance to go to the World Series, that team sort of rang out as almost the modern-day Cubs as we know it. For the players that aren't here, Ron Santo, for Ernie Banks and the others, I mean, do you think about the idea that some of the people that you went into battle with aren't here to see the Cubs actually make the World Series?
Well, yeah, you have to think about it. you know, Dick Selma was on that ball club, Gene Oliver, Jim Hickman. So many guys have not, to me, had that opportunity to celebrate because of the fact that, you know, life is very short. And unfortunately, they're not with us now. Mm-hmm. And they would be proud, just like all the rest of us that are still alive. We're going to celebrate with these young men if they have a chance to do it. And just to be proud that we were part of the history, even though we didn't win.
You know, to be such have so many statistics and so many accolades, and to be a Hall of Fame pitcher, to wear number 31, to be one of the best, if not the best pitcher that the Chicago Cubs have ever had. What does it mean to you? I mean, as a Canadian ball player, I mean, you're Canadian Hall of Fame as well, but what does it mean to you to be at the upper echelon in Cubs history?
Well, the pride of putting on the uniform and then playing as well as I did, winning a lot of ball games, and then the honor of having your number retired, and it flies on the flagpole with all so many other guys. You know, Greg Maddux wore 31 mm-hmm. for quite a few years. Ernie Banks, Sandberg, Billy Williams, Ron Santo. I just think that it's a pride that a lot of times you can't express and put into words because of the fact that you played with these fellas. You played against good players. And as a pitcher, I tell people all the time, you don't do it alone. So I had good teammates to get me to where I'm at now, to be a Hall of Famer. So that's the pride of knowing that you played as well as you could, and the Hall of Fame is an award along with having your number retired as a Chicago Cub.
There's no way we're going to see you this weekend throwing out the first pitch, huh?
I'm going to be there with
you. Will
with Greg Maddux on Saturday throwing out the first pitch. It probably won't be a good pitch, but I'll throw it out there.
That's amazing. Well, we'll look forward to that here in Chicago. I think that's a very fitting tribute to my guest tonight, Fergie Jenkins, the best pitcher in Chicago Cubs history, good old number 31, Hall of Fame pitcher for the Cubs. Mr. Jenkins, thanks for taking some time out tonight. We really appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure. All right, guys, good luck.
All right, let's get an update on tonight's game. Everybody in Chicago, excited to hear this update from Rob Martyr. This.
Deep breath, Justin. Not the start that the Cubs and their fans wanted. We're still working in the bottom of the first inning. John Lester, of course, getting the start for the Cubbies tonight. He has issues throwing over to first base, yeah. And already the base is loaded, two out. He's walked in a run. He has the yips in going over to first.
It's
There's
strange,
a bit of an issue there, yeah.
I don't know what it is. There's just something about the fact that these guys, and they're challenging him. They're we've seen it right now, 2-0. Base is still loaded, so.
Well, you said it. Whatever psychologically Lester's got going on in terms of throwing over to first, and not only that, he's a lefty. He can see first base.
At the World Series, wouldn't it be great if he like broke that psychological barrier?
Sure.
Like for his whole career, he's like done, picked off.
And well, then like, what you do is you put the Indians on their heels.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
Touche. It's 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy.
Hey, Cubs.
For our weekly
Go Cubs.
Go Cubs segment.
Go Cubs, go.
We were breaking down politics, of course, the 2016 campaign here. Talk of what? Two weeks from tonight,
yeah,
this thing might be over.
We'll be celebrating the Cubs.
We'll be celebrating the Cubs. There'll be a parade somewhere. All right, so let's talk about this. I'm interested. There's a couple things to talk about. One of which, why don't we start with voter turnout? We've seen in Illinois tremendous voter turnout, especially in the city of Chicago. More than we've seen in years. But you're seeing it in different places as well. I mean, let's talk specifically about what we can expect from this election when it comes to voter turnout across the country.
So in the key swing states, the early voting numbers are mostly good for Democrats. In Florida, Democrats are up significantly both in early voting and in absentee voting. Usually Republicans have the edge in absentee. Right now, Democrats have the edge in absentee voting. Plus, they have a big edge in early voting. And in Iowa, which is thought to be a Trump state, Democrats have a huge edge in early voting. And so in most places other than Ohio, the Republicans seem the Democrats are underperforming. Republicans are overperforming. Look, the whole idea of these early votes is that you want to put votes in the bank so that if you figure right now the lead is somewhere between 5 and 12 points, depending on which poll you believe, those are all good numbers for Hillary. So the more votes you get in the bank today, the better off you're going to be.
Of course, yeah.
And it makes the hole that much bigger on Election Day.
Early voting is somewhat new, I mean, when it comes to presidential campaigns, in the sense that, you know, I mean, we're seeing a different way that we're digitally being able to do this kind of thing. But for you, Chris, has it changed the way you think about the election, the fact that so many votes have already been cast?
Yeah, you gotta see Kyle Schwarber just struck out. Sorry to say that.
You're right.
Thank you for sharing your screen with us.
Did Donald Trump just struck out, Chris?
Okay. Oh, wow.
There you go. Tying it all together.
Really witty. Okay, so here we go. Early voting means that you've got to get to likely voters sooner, which means you're talking to a lot of voters longer. You don't have to concentrate all your voter contact communications at the end of the campaign. Mm-hmm. I do want to say it's very quaint now. Quaint. People used to say there was a rule of thumb, and as late as the 60s and into the 70s, people didn't focus on the presidential campaign until the World Series was over.
Wow, interesting.
Because in the old dark days, there was only a World Series. There were no playoffs. So you basically would be turning to the World Series, turning to the presidential about
by mid-October.
Right now.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, I think early voting is it raises the cost of the campaign, and it creates the possibility that people are going to vote and die. That's not statistically significant. That's not a big deal. Those votes should not be counted, but they will be counted. You know, there's no way to separate them out. But the other thing is it does create the possibility you vote and then you have remorse. Like you're for Hillary, but then you see something out of WikiLeaks, or for Trump, but then he insults another category of human being. You finally say, that's too many.
You can't take it back. That's right.
You know, I was okay until...
You guys have been... We talked about this last week, just the idea of the Electoral College. I mean, it's still... Nothing has changed really in a week's time, that it's really still a rugged path for Donald Trump to be able... when it comes to predictions.
Yeah.
It could all go wrong on Election Day. But is that accurate to say that it's going to be a difficult attempt for Donald Trump when it comes to the electoral map?
It's an exceedingly difficult path for Donald Trump. Even their best estimates, their best case scenario, say that he's got 266. But that includes states that he doesn't have a snowball's chance in, such as Michigan, where all the polls are double digits. Keep an eye on Utah. Utah is a really big deal because...
Why is Utah a big... Who cares about Utah? Why could it... How could it be a big deal?
Chris, that's an excellent question. I'm so glad you asked.
You guys should teach a civics lesson.
So,
thank you.
So Utah, which is only worth, I believe, 5 electoral votes... but there are 5 critical votes. If Donald Trump can only get to 271, which is the expectation that he's got on the electoral map as of right now, if he doesn't get Utah, he's at 266. And Utah is showing a surprising surge for the fifth party candidate, Evan McMullen, a retired security guy who is a Mormon and who is, in some polls, leading in Utah, or at the very least in all the polls, in second place in Utah.
This could be viewed by some observers as conservatives' revenge against Trump, and revenge also against the establishment, although the establishment's not for Trump. But Evan McMullen, a very bright guy, he's had a series of very responsible jobs, some of them in business, some of them in Capitol Hill. He really knows policy. He's a very has he been on the show? Have you had him
no,
on?
No, I have not. No.
So he's a very... articulate proponent of what you would sort of term, you know, traditional conservative policies. And he was the best that the so-called Never Trump movement inside the Republican Party could come up with. And so this was led by Bill Kristol and a few other people that came
and
up.
And it seems to be working in Utah.
Well, and
if not anywhere else.
Now you're looking, well, and he is Mormon. And he's from Utah.
Right.
So all of his high school buddies, his grade school buddies, you know, the young lady he went to the prom with, everybody's out knocking on doors for this guy.
And he's a real conservative. And his theory of the case is that if it's a, you know, razor thin election, which it's not. But if it were, Utah could send this entire election into the House of Representatives, where Republicans hold the majority and can elect a real conservative, a real Republican, instead of Donald J. Trump. That's the theory of the case.
Which actually, I don't think we're going to get to that, as David just said, but it happens to be the case. And we saw this on Veep, of all places, a tremendous, probably the best show on TV, except for the Americans. But Veep had this great thing where the result had to be determined by the House of Representatives.
Right.
That's an ancient, rarely, I think only used once or twice.
Once or twice, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I don't know. I mean, if this catches fire, then I think that David's right. I mean, if present trends continue, Trump will not have a path to 271.
All right, let's take a quick break. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy. Because when we come back, let's talk about what could get in the way of the tide and the momentum for both candidates with only 2 weeks left until election night. It's Touche, Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling here on The Download. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
It's Touche
David
here.
Is all wrong about that. I'm telling you.
Oh, Chris, would you pay attention to some numbers for a change?
You know, facts can be inconvenient, but you don't get to write them out of the story, David.
Why? You do all the time.
Conversation picks up on air now. With Touche, Chris Rowling, and Dave Lundy. We're talking politics. 2 weeks till the election. What's going to stand in the way? Let's
Munger Mendoza.
Yeah, I was.
This is the race all are watching.
I'm sorry, who's Munger Mendoza?
It's the Munger Games. Leslie Munger's finally attacking that idiot Susan Mendoza, who's the nicest lady in the world. She's wonderful. Don't get me wrong.
She's not an idiot. Her name is Susana Mendoza.
Susana Mendoza.
Which, if you weren't against Latinos, you might have known that.
Susana Mendoza, and she is Mike Madigan groupie.
No, she's not.
And she nominated him or seconded him or something at the inauguration. I mean, she's just like two peas in a pod with Madigan. And Rauner appointed Munger, but Munger actually turned on Rauner and has had some incidents of independence, whereas Mendoza, she just waits to be told what to do.
I'm sorry. What independence has Leslie Munger had from Bruce Rauner?
Oh,
you mean when she chooses which radio station to listen to? That's her independence.
Because
sure as hell ain't president or governing.
You know, down there in Springfield, they all know that
she decides if she wants to have country or western.
Ooh,
we will get into the down ballot.
We got to get into the down ballot.
We will. We got.
I'm only here this week. Next week, I'm out of town.
You're out of town next week.
He's out of the country.
That's amazing timing.
Sorry.
WikiLeaks.
Yes, sir.
Give me your, what's your biggest takeaway from WikiLeaks?
So the Cubs aren't looking good.
He's pivoting away from WikiLeaks, you see?
I don't understand. Like, what, tell me, Chris, what's the takeaway, the number one thing to take away from the WikiLeaks?
Well, I think that the contempt for the regular person that we heard from that guy who was the architect of Obamacare, which is crashing and burning as we speak, permeates the entire higher reaches of the Hillary operation. And it's basically, you know, this is the traditional, and I mean, since about 1890, 1880 in Germany with Bismarck and the origins of the progressive era, you've got this sort of sense that there are experts and contemporary society is too complicated. The regular person can't understand. And therefore, we, the technocratic expert, whether you go to Stanford or Harvard or Texas A&M, you know better. And that's how Hillary operates. And it is throughout the entire. And there are insults to Catholics. There are insults to Hispanics. I think that there's no pay to play in there that I can tell. Not yet.
But just the overall tone, you feel, is something that...
I mean, they're disparaging of the regular person. They're disparaging of the regular voter.
So that was a very interesting exposition you just gave, Professor. But the most interesting part of the exposition is that the big, exciting news coming out of thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of email is that there is no pay to play, which you just admitted.
I just said.
Exactly. Exactly. That's my point.
But nobody said there would be pay to play at the
Chris,
at the
you campaign. Guys were so excited about WikiLeaks.
The pay to play is all over. No, I the pay to
you guys were all excited about WikiLeaks.
No one was excited.
WikiLeaks
no
has amounted to nothing. There's nothing in there except a campaign running a campaign. What you have learned.
That is what you
What said. You have learned in WikiLeaks is that there's a candidate who acts like a politician. There's a campaign that's frustrated with the candidate, said every campaign staff ever. You have campaign staffers talking about people in the way the campaign staffers talk about
people.
Well,
let me ask you, I mean, one thing that's popping out when we talk about issues is, and you mentioned it, the Affordable Care Act. And,
right.
And right now, there seems to, it's starting to ratchet up. You're seeing more and more, Donald Trump is putting more and more time on it, talking about it's a disaster. It's a,
God, it must be 6 minutes to the election.
Yeah. But is, I mean,
why,
is that
why? So early? What's the rush?
Is that
David,
resonating?
What is the rush?
Is the sort of attack on the quote-unquote Obamacare, is that resonating? Is that something? Because I feel like that's something that we almost want politics to go away from, in the sense that we just spent 8 years of Congress trying to repeal something, and they're back at it with 2 weeks to go.
So here's what's happening. The Obama administration just acknowledged as part of their annual review that the average increase for silver plans, the benchmark plan, is going to be 22%. In some states, it's going to be higher. In Indiana, for example, it's lower. It's -1%. That's who's responsible.
Mike Pence.
In any event,
way to go, Indiana.
There is a significant noticing of the fact that premiums are going to go up. Now, with the subsidies, they're not going to go up that much, and in some cases, they don't go up very much at all. But the key point here that counts
only 7 minutes
is that is that. The Republicans have refused to negotiate fixes to Obamacare that Democrats have said that they need to negotiate. Instead, for the last, 5 years, all Republicans have done is try to repeal it 74 times. And instead, they should be trying to fix it, just like Democrats did after George W. Bush passed Medicare Part D prescription drug coverage, which was a disaster, until Democrats partnered with Republicans to fix it. So, Chris, the question is, when Hillary is elected, are you guys finally going to stop trying to repeal Obamacare and start trying to fix it to help the people?
No.
Exactly. No, you're not.
No, we stand for repealing Obamacare and getting health care back to the people and not to the bureaucracy. You know what we're
back
seeing
when
here,
they didn't have health care because pre-existing conditions negated them.
Excuse me. What we are talking about here is the absolutely, ridiculous attempt by the Obama administration to create a marketplace for health care for millions and millions and millions of Americans with no increase in the ability of the American medical system to provide health care. So you've got a fixed amount of health care delivery, and you then change the rules of the game. Now, I'm not vested in the old rules. I'm not vested in Obamacare, obviously. But these guys said this will be nirvana. And everybody who had ever taken Econ 101 said, wait a minute, you're dramatically increasing demand. There's no increase in supply. Prices are going to go up and the exchanges are going to collapse. So what happened? They increased demand, supply was fixed, the exchanges have collapsed, and the prices are skyrocketing. David wants to say, it's okay that prices are going up 22% on average for the silver plan. However, just because there's notice. He says there's due notice. That's not enough.
No, that's not what I just
this
said.
You said there's notice for the. There, this isn't.
No, I
this
said
is
that's
not
why people
are
paying attention
promised.
Now.
Apart from the complete ridiculous, really betrayal of President Obama. If you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. If you like your plan, you can keep.
And
your
here
plan.
We go down memory
just
lane.
A complete lie.
Which I appreciate it, but last time I checked, back when I was first had a health care plan for my employees, the second year of my plan, the cost went up 40%. This is not unprecedented. It is problematic, but. The idea is that we should fix it. Chris wants to end it, as do Republicans. We have no answer. But the political implications are that Trump has an opportunity to make a case. But as usual, even today, instead of talking about it, he said, well, they say it's 22%, but it's really 100% they're
he
going
just
up.
He exaggerates. All right. This week, what do we see from Trump? Quick.
I think there will be more focus on the issues. I don't know if it's too late.
Clinton.
It's too late.
It's too late, babe, and now it's too late.
Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling.
This was our World Series edition.
So you will not be here next week. I will not be here. But the week after, you will be back. We'll have a special Touche the Monday before election.
I think that'll be the day before the election.
And I'll be here for Game 7 and our World Series Touche coverage.
Touche. Thank you, Rob. Justin Kaufman here on The Download, 720 WGN. With you till 11 o'clock tonight. At 10 o'clock, we will start post-game for this World Series game, which is moving pretty fast. The Indians in the lead right now, 2-0. Corey Kluber and John Lester, though, settling in strikeout after strikeout as they run through the third. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Joe Montana is going to join us. We're going to talk about the 39th year of Bleacher Bums, the 1977 play at the Organic Theater, which was loosely based, if not completely based on the nationally recognized Bleacher Bums, the collection of guys who would hang out in the bleachers at Wrigley Field in the 70s and 80s. We will talk with Joe Montana and Stuart Gordon about Bleacher Bums and their work at the Organic Theater. All right. Well, this summer, Chicago got a new man to head up the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events. Mark Kelly comes over from Columbia College, where he spent 32 years to take the reins here. Former Commissioner Michelle Boone moved on to work at Navy Pier. So what should we expect from the new head of DCASE? Mark Kelly is my guest tonight. Mr. Kelly, nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Justin, it's great to be here.
All right, so let's talk about that. I mean, this is such an interesting post because, you know, Lois Weisberg was there for years. Michelle Boone was really sort of head up the cultural plan. I mean, there really is a movement to essentially define how we have arts and culture in our lives in Chicago. What attracted you to this job?
Oh, well, just to have an office in the Cultural Center, the People's Palace, to be in charge of the Millennium Park, one of the greatest cultural assets in the world, and to be part of Chicago, one of the cultural powerhouses of the world, though maybe not understood or appreciated by even our own citizens about how what a player we are in cultural creation, but to me, it's a kid in a candy store.
Why is that? Why do you think that is? Why do you think Chicagoans don't recognize the international scope of our arts and culture?
Well, it's one of the conundrums of Chicago, where when you look at what's been created in Chicago, whether it's improv, whether it's storefront theater, whether it's the urban blues, which created the rock and roll as we know it, you know, the jazz as we know it came out of Chicago, and house music, and the list just goes on and on. But yet, is it the second city syndrome? Is it it's a city that has never understood or believed that arts and culture is one of the most important defining characteristics of who we are. I helped create the Muddy Waters mural. I don't know if you've seen it. It's a 10-story mural right at State and Madison. Okay. It's right over the Old Navy.
Yeah, right.
And it's amazing. Here's one of the greatest musical icons in the world. The Rolling Stones named themselves after his song, and Rolling Stone magazine is after his song. And yet I will ask people, who is that? And they don't know. And he's one of our musical icons. And if we were in New Orleans or Nashville or in Austin, you know, you would know who had created what. So, you know, I think part of the future of Chicago is we will always be a cultural powerhouse, and we maybe ever more are. But we need to connect that better to the life of our citizens.
I'm interested because, you know, you'll hear this, you know, there's so many artists will come in this studio and people will talk about their lives as theater artists or musicians and otherwise. But they're trying to make it as artists, or they're making art outside of the realm. They're living, breathing parts of our city. Why do we need a government agency to sort of promote or engage or connect us when it comes to arts and culture? Why can't we just sort of let the artists of our city create and be in the sort of free marketplace, if that makes sense?
Well, that free marketplace is not kind to artists. And if we let it just to be to the free marketplace, our artists would not be supported. They would not be encouraged. There would not be the platforms. We would also not have places like Millennium Park and the Cultural Center. We would not have the public art that fills our spaces and helps us love our city. We wouldn't have the Riverwalk. We wouldn't have the Picasso. Without a governmental agency, this would be a meat and potatoes town, and it would be soulless and empty and without joy. But without a governmental agency to help promote that, to celebrate it, to advocate, we would be left to our more base and mercantile expressions of how we should live.
Well, I mean, we're talking with Mark Kelly. He's the new head of DCAES, Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events, which, as I mentioned, I mean, has been a, I mean, it's been such a, I guess, a department that's been well known in this city. Lois Weisberg, you know, created such a place for artists, whether it be all the things that are done at the Cultural Center, the revival of the Cultural Center, the festivals that we have in this town. There has definitely been an impact that the DCAES, or DCAES is the new, but the Department of Cultural Affairs has had. Are you aware of the history of this department?
Oh, yes. I you know, I'm humbled to follow in Lois Weisberg and Michelle Boone, the accomplishments of DCAES and its in the different iterations of that office, but Blues Fest and Jazz Fest and all of our arts grants that go out to artists and to cultural organizations and Millennium Park and the list goes on. There's no other office like this at any city in the country. We offer more free events, more compelling, authentic, gritty, great cultural events like we do in Chicago and the joy we bring. And then we're now pushing it out into the neighborhoods. I think there's maybe, if anything, the big shift is we don't want just culture and art in the central district of the city. We want it in every neighborhood. This year of public art, this Mayor Emanuel initiative is to redefine where art shows up. It's not just the Picasso and the Bean and the Buckingham,
which has
and
been
the Lions.
I mean, it's been a criticism of the city and the Department of Cultural Affairs over the years, not, you know, not just recent, but over the years, that Chicago will do everything it can for downtown and this area, and we'll have nice light shows and fountains and things of that nature. But in the neighborhoods, there's no investment, especially when it comes to arts and culture. So the Year of Public Art, which the mayor's initiative just put out this week, That's sort of addressing that concern.
You know, I think it's a game changer because just think of our thoughts about public art and how they've shifted over time. So at one point, public art was just the ceremonial. It was, you know, celebrating the World War II veteran or the Civil War veteran or a moment of time, a point of history. And then with the particularly with the Picasso sculpture, which, by the way, when that came out, the populace was horrified. The number of radio shows and TV shows and editorials about how have we let this unknown, unrecognizable thing come into the city.
They wanted to make a statue of Ernie Banks.
Yeah. Right? but so then it we started to accept art for art's sake. And I think this next movement led by our Mayor Emanuel is that art should be in the public way. Art should be in every neighborhood. And we're investing $1.5 million for some major new initiatives literally in every ward in this city.
Mark Kelly's the new commissioner for the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. You know, you were in front of the city council or through committees yesterday talking about the idea of festivals and what you mentioned about the cultural events that are offered for free, budgets and taxes and everything that goes into the money and the finances that the city finds itself for the financial situation. Some aldermen questioning whether or not we should go the way of other cities and start charging for Blues Fest, for Jazz Fest, for Taste of Chicago and otherwise. We'll talk about that coming back here on the Download 720 WGN. Stay with us. Talking arts and culture tonight here on 720 WGN. Mark Kelly, he's the new commissioner for the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events. Big announcement this week from Mayor Emanuel, an initiative called the Year of Public Art for 2017, where he wants to bring an investment. It was $1.5 million to neighborhoods to be able to have public art in all Chicago neighborhoods. That's something that you know, is always at the heart of the conversation about whether or not Chicago is giving arts and culture through the Department of cultural affairs or otherwise, to neighborhoods and not just downtown. The other thing that downtown brings is the festivals. And that's the Jazz Fest and the Blues Fest, the Taste of Chicago, so many festivals. And this week you got in front of City Council, some of the aldermen, who question, hey, we're having so many budget issues and, you know, pensions and all this kind of stuff. Is it time to start thinking about putting a cover charge on the Blues Fest? Is it time to start thinking about, you know, $10 for Taste of Chicago to get down to Grant Park and Jackson? I mean, is that something when is that something you're considering? I mean, you sort of had to tap dance around on the committee, but is that something that we've seen in other cities? I mean, is it time to sort of think about the financial implications of giving away free cultural events?
Well, I won't tap dance around it because the answer is no, we're not going to head in that direction. In fact, I want to go in the opposite direction. So in this city, with all of the economic challenges that our citizens face, we need to make culture accessible to them, and we have to do it in a variety of ways. And so one part of that is our great festivals have to remain free. When you go to the Jazz Fest and see the incredible diversity of that audience, mm-hmm. You add that fee, and by the way, over 50% of those in attendance are from Chicago, that equation changes dramatically. So we see at our downtown festivals a diversity that you don't see at most other events in the city. In what can be a very segregated city, these cultural events are alive, they're inviting, they're accessible, they're available to everyone. And now we're pushing that idea out into the parks. So the night out in the parks, DCase was a major funder of the Park District event. We had 1,600 events in the park during the summer, audience of 200,000.
Which is different than a festival. I mean, the format's changed. So let's talk about that. I mean, the idea right now that a jazz festival is going to be a weekend kind of thing with, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and you'll have events and it's all down Millennium Park or in the old Grant Park space. You know, do we start rethinking the way we do festivals in the city?
Well, I think we do to a certain degree because we had the festivals back when there was little else going on in the city. Now we have Riot Fest and Lollapalooza, and the list goes on and on and on and on and on. And the question remains, how do we connect our citizens to great, authentic, compelling culture? And we can do that in a variety of ways. And so it doesn't have to be just the grand festival and even the festivals themselves. So I want to make sure that let's go back to the Jazz Fest. The role of Jazz Fest is not just to provide a free event where someone goes and, I'll go to this when it's free. Rather, it's to get them to go to it and then encourage them that, wow, this is so compelling. This is music that I typically don't listen to, and I have to get out to these clubs. Mm-hmm. We have to build the cultural environment through these free events, not sort of undo them because they're free. And there's so many new formats that we need to consider. The point is accessibility, culture alive, cultural events available. And they become much more present.
Do you see, and this was brought up as well in the committee meeting, just do you see DCase going into a different direction to honor or explore other art forms? I mean, we just saw on the Cook County Board, kind of going off the idea of what house music and DJ music or rap music. Do you see the Department of Cultural Affairs shifting at some point and being able to deliver festivals around newer types of music, younger types of music?
I don't know if there'll be festivals, but we surely must represent the cultural ferment that's around us and not just what happened 20 years ago. So house, hip hop, I love it. It was just a month ago. We had three major Chicago artists hosting festival or major cultural events. So we had Kanye West, you know, doing his thing at the United Center, and we had Common in Union
Fest,
Park,
yeah.
And then we had Chance with this incredible event in Comiskey Park or whatever we're supposed to call it, and I think that was really important that these artists in the moment creating work that is powerful on the globe, and there are artists and they're showing what they can do. So we have to honor the forms of today, the footwork community, the dance community, the jukers, and so I'll give you an example of the summer dance. Mm-hmm. We're going to do a summer dance off in the city. We're going to push summer dance. Everyone loves the idea of the citizen dancer. Instead of being edified by dance, you go and dance. And we're going to push it out into more of our neighborhoods. But then we're going to have a competition. Let's see that stepping ensemble that wins in Jackson Park. Let's see that salsa ensemble that wins in, let's say, Douglas Park. And then we're going to bring them all down in August. We're going to have a giant citizen dance festival in Millennium Park. And the winners will get on the main stage that evening, and we'll mix them with some professional dance troupes who have a street art aesthetic. And here we are honoring new youthful dance forms. Here we are pushing an art form out into the neighborhoods, and then we're bringing back and recentering it in the city, and we're breaking down that false idea that it's either or. It's either the downtown or it's the neighborhood.
Well, let me ask you, as we wrap up here, you know, the one thing that was a big part of the Department of Cultural Affairs in the last 5 years was the cultural plan. Mm-hmm. There was a lot made of, and you were advisor on it, and you worked to put a cultural plan together, and this was a big thing for the mayor, to put a plan together for the city to work off of. Do you find yourself as being the new commissioner? Are you going to honor that? I mean, is it something that you follow the blueprint that was put together, or was that sort of an exercise, and that exercise has run its course, and it's time for a new cultural plan?
I'm not going to say it's time for a new cultural plan, but plans have to be living and organic. And so that was absolutely necessary, important. It gave a direction. One of the most important directions was activate culture in our neighborhoods. But if you just start getting caught 5 years later as following a plan, you're going to be a little stilted and a little wooden, because things change, things move. So we're bringing fresh eyes to everything we do within D-Case. We're talking to cultural leaders. We're hearing what people are saying on the street, and using the cultural plan offers us a sense of direction. It offers us big ideas, but we're not just caught with that as a blueprint, because it's not like construction.
Yeah,
it's living. It's organic. It's ever shifting.
Well, I'd love to have you come back. I think that, you know, this is an opportunity for the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events and the download. Every time we have an issue with cultural affairs in this town, you're in studio. How about that?
Justin, I'd love to join you.
Mark Kelly is the new commissioner for the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events. The mayor came out this week saying this is the year of public art. 2017 will be the year of public art. And that we'll see how that plays out in 2017. Mark Kelly, thanks for being my guest tonight. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Justin. Thank you.
All right. Coming up, we'll shift right back into Chicago Cubs culture. Jim Hendry's going to join us, the former general manager for the Cubs before Theo Epstein. He's also watching intently tonight as two of his draft picks, Javi Baez and Wilson Contreras, are in the World Series. Javi Baez in the lineup tonight, Wilson Contreras not, but he probably will see time. Although they don't do as much pinch hitting in the AL side of this because it's you know, the DH,
yeah,
which I know Zimmerman hates the DH. I like the DH only because although I saw in the NLCS why it's fun to have a pitcher in the way all the switches and changes and unbelievable amount of strategy that goes into it is so fun around the pitcher batting.
Well, Kyle Schwarber, out since April, in the lineup tonight, has only been up to the plate once. Took a couple of big cuts. He's 0 for 1.
0 for 1.
Yeah, 0 for 1.
Struck out.
To be expected, though. To be expected.
I know. It's hard for me to understand. I mean, I guess it's the old adage, you know. Hey, if you can, you know, if you want to knock the rust off, start in the World Series.
Hey, man, it's as good a time as any.
They
right?
taught you that in Little League, yeah. You know. Hey, take some time off, and if you're looking, if you need to get back into it, take some practice swings, do it in the World Series. That's what I've always heard. Yeah, you know the old adage. They teach you in Little League.
Yes.
Get your first hit in the World Series.
Good a place as any.
That's what they always make. I remember my coach at the Wonder Lake Pirates would be like, Justin, this is what you got.
I only ever had one hit in my Little League career.
Really?
It was a triple, and I slid into third base. I forgot to call a timeout, and I was promptly tagged out.
No.
Tragic.
Like you got up off the base?
Well, having never been on base before, I wasn't quite sure what to do, and
My buddy who was playing third base for the other team tagged me out.
That's ridiculous. I one time, and I will say this from my friend Chris Schmidt, who lives in Wonder Lake. I don't know if he still lives there or not. Remember the trend in which you would walk and then you would round first base like you were going to take second on the walk?
Yeah.
That was like a little league thing. You never see, like, it's like, well, that's great base running. Well, we had this thing going where you would throw down to first base and then I would play first base and I would hide the ball like I didn't have it, you know? Like I just have my hands on my hip. Like I was nice. I can't believe we walked another guy.
Just chilling.
Yeah. And he rounded the base. I couldn't believe it. Put the tag on him. He's out. That was like a 3 week thing. At least a 3 week thing that we talked about it. Good old Harrison. But all right, coming up here on the download, we're going to talk with former general manager for the Cubs, Jim Hendry. He will join us to talk about his two picks. He signed Javi Baez, who he drafted, and then he also signed Wilson Contreras, who was an international pick. Not a draft pick, but an international pick. But, yeah, we'll talk to him about and I didn't recognize this till I was actually going through the research that Jim Hendry is the most, I guess, the winningest general manager in Cubs history. The only general manager with three postseason appearances and the only general manager in Cubs history to go back-to-back 07-08. So we'll talk with Jim Hendry, who's watching this game tonight. The Indians just got a solo home run. They lead 3-0 in the bottom of the fourth. So we will talk with Jim about that. And also just about the hoopla and being a general manager and the ups and downs of being in a front office when you're trying to put together championships. Really getting to the mind of a general manager and how an architect and when you have to put these teams together and what happens when you get the team that you want, you get it on the field and you end up being a couple out short, as the Cubs were in 2003. So we'll talk with Jim Hendry about that coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, Cubs down 3-0 in the top of the fifth inning in Cleveland. One guy who's watching intently, mostly as a fan, maybe, and a former employee of the organization, is none other than former Cubs general manager Jim Hendry. Hendry was let go from the team in 2011, but not before he became the most winningest GM in Cubs history with playoff appearances in 2003, 2007, and 2008. He brought in Dusty Baker, Lou Piniella, and his final work, signing two young players in 2011, those two, Javi Baez and Wilson Contreras. Jim Hendry's my guest tonight on The Download. Mr. Hendry, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
No, glad to be with you. Just, anxious to get to watch the rest of the game, but no problem talking for a few minutes.
All right, we got you. We'll watch it for you. All right, so let me ask you, as a former general manager, I mean, do you watch it like the rest of us? I mean, when you're watching a game like this where the Cubs are down 3-0 in the fourth, what's the emotion that goes through a general manager watching a game like this?
Well, it's different now that I'm not the GM and I work for the Yankees, and obviously we're not in it, but we're going to be fighting our way back to get in it like the Yankees are used to doing. But I have obviously more than a vested interest in a fan. You know, I've had 17 years with the Cubs, and I have so many friends that are still there, and I have a good relationship with Theo and Tom Ricketts, and a lot of people that worked there have been there a long time. So it's a special thing for me, too. I still, have a house here in Chicago. My kids were raised at Wrigley Field, so... and I'll be at the games this weekend. So, hopefully the Cubs will do it. I think they've got the best club, and hopefully they're not even done tonight. It just takes one good inning, and you're right back in it.
Yeah. Well, talk about, when you're building a team like this, and we've seen and we've kind of talked about this, and we've promoted the fact that you were involved with some of the signings as well, and Theo Epstein in some of the post-game interviews on Saturdays, corrected a lot of the reporters when they said young players like Javi Baez and Wilson Contreras, those are players that you brought in. Talk about, building a team like this team where it's so young and you're counting on such talent, raw talent.
Well, this is one of the greatest jobs in baseball history, I think, that Theo's done. I mean, what he's done here in the last 3 or 4 years and to accumulate the talent here, and he had so much credibility coming in with two World Series championships under his belt. It takes a guy like that with that kind of clout in a big market to, just basically explain to everyone that we're going to tear it down and start over. Usually you're trying to win every year and compete and contend. And Theo had a great vision, and Tom Ricketts allowed Theo to do it his way. But this is you can say you can rebuild it and we're going to take our time. But the job that he's done and the bullseyes that he's hit in the draft and in the great trades he's made, this has come together in high fashion. And the Cubs are going to be very good for quite a while. This is not a one-hit wonder. This is going to be a sustained, successful club, and hopefully it'll turn into a world championship for the city.
All right, for you, let's go back. I mean, you've had two runs, really, that were legendary in Chicago Cubs history, one in 2003, of course, and then 2007, 2008. In the 2003 season, to be a general manager in a team where there's this feeling that this so-called curse and this thing is going to end and you're going to go, and then to have it kind of play out the way that it did. Mm-hmm. How does that play for you emotionally? How does it play as the GM for a team that, on all accounts, should have gone to the World Series?
Yeah, well, it was devastating. You know, I had been here 7 or 8 years before I was a GM as the farm director and scouting director, and that was actually my first year as GM, and it was one of those years where, you know, nobody thought we were going to win, you know, before the season, and it was just one of those magical years. Everything that we did and every deal we made, it was kind of like it worked out perfect. And all of a sudden we found ourselves 7 back before the trade deadline a week before, and then took off after we, made a few great trades. But it was something that the Marlins were a great team and, you know, obviously became the world champs. But when we came home with a 3-2 lead and Pryor and Wood ready to pitch, I think it was human nature. You thought we're going to win it. And game 6, we had shut them out for 7 innings and then the roof fell in. So it was devastating. It's something you really never get over because, what's happened this year really could have and we thought should have happened that year.
For you, yeah. I mean, as a general manager, you wanted to repeat in 2004. You know, talk about the concept of being that close and continuing to stay on the sort of mm-hmm. mission, what you wanted to accomplish
in
2004.
Yeah, actually, we had a great offseason. We were a much better team in 2004. You know, we got Derek Lee in the offseason. We brought Greg Maddux back and made like a Troy Hawkins signings and Todd Hollinsworth, you know, pieces that fit to a world championship puzzle. And unfortunately, that by the time we got to the 1st of May, Wood and Pryor and Joe Borowski, our closer, and Mark Grzelcyk, they were all in the DL and obviously with some significant injuries. So the Cubs are built now with younger players and not really too many guys approaching free agency for a while. I think they're built to be successful for longer. But we really felt in 2004 that's when everybody picked us to win, not 2003, that we thought we had a much better club, and it just didn't happen. So there's no guarantees in this game. The best teams don't always win. But with the type of thing that Theo has put together here, I think it's going to last for quite a while.
Jim Hendry's my guest, former Cubs GM. We're talking about the game of baseball, but also just about Cubs history. It's the Cubs right now in the top of the 5th inning, down 3-0 to the Indians here in the World Series Game 1. You know, I'm really interested at when you decide to rebuild. You know, like you guys almost did a rebuild, if you will, between the 2004 and what you guys put on the field in 2007, 2008, new coach Lou Piniella. But as a general manager, how does that come about when you decide that, okay, we're going to rebuild a franchise?
Well, it's a collective decision. Obviously, ownership is first and foremost. And I think in the old days, it's a little different than now. When you're in a big market like Chicago or New York or L.A. or Boston, and we were owned by the Tribune Company, who were great people. Dennis Fitzsimons, John Maddox, and Jim Dowdle were the bosses I had over the years with the Tribune. They were terrific. But, you know, pretty much the goal every year was to try to get in the playoffs and try to win. And back then, things weren't, you know, the game was different then. Free agency was different. The draft was different. And I don't think back then you could sit up and say, we're going to rebuild, tear the whole thing down right. In a big market, you know, so basically we thought we could contend, you know, literally probably 4 of my first 6 years. We won 3 divisions in the first 6. And I thought, like I said, in 2004, we probably had one of our better clubs. So I think you have to look at it like Theo did when you come in and you know, when the club got sold, we had some backloaded contracts and there were 3 owners here in the last 5 years between the Tribune and then Sam Zell. And then, of course, the Ricketts family came in and bought the club with the great vision ahead. So I think you have to have the ownership and the general manager, and in this case the president, all collectively think that is the best thing for the franchise long term. It can't be just a decision made by the GM. It has to really start with the ownership. And obviously the modern day situation is the blueprints being done by Theo, but it's not just that easy where somebody else can stand up and say, well, we're going to do it like the Cubs.
Right.
It's Theo's a special guy, and you know, obviously this is one of the best jobs I think done in the history of the game here. And so it's not that easy. You have to get, you still have to nail the draft choices. You still have to nail the trades. You still have to have great baseball people working for you. And obviously when Theo hired Joe Maddon, I thought that was the final piece of the puzzle to kind of round the young guys together and get them to play the way they have. And Joe certainly deserves a ton of credit also.
Jim, what's the hardest part about the job of general manager? When you mentioned all the things you just mentioned, from everything of when to rebuild or draft picks or blueprints, what's the hardest job of a general manager?
The hardest part by far is like losing game 6 in 03. Things like that you quite never get over, or when you think you have a heck of a team, you know, like we did in 04 and have probably the best young pitching in baseball, and then injuries that you're out of everybody's control happen. I mean, Kerry Wood could have been a long-term 20-game winner prior. Sombrano was a great young pitcher. You know, Greg Maddux came in to round things off. So you always feel like when you have the type of team that could win and you don't, it's the most devastating thing about it to me. You know, the other parts are, you know, a lot of fun. I mean, some of the, you know, making deals and making trades and having good relationships with players and seeing the way the fan base love things here. And when you're winning here, there's no place better. And so most of it was fun, and look back over 17 years, it was a very enjoyable process, you know, till the last year or two. And those are the things you remember the most, but the difficult part is knowing when you could and should have won and you can't quite finish it off.
Last question, just about Javi Baez and Wilson Contreras. Think back to that time 5 years ago about what you saw, what talent. I mean, think about the draft first with Javier Baez. I mean, what were you looking at with a player like that?
You know, to be honest with you, Tim Wilkin was our scouting director, who was a tremendous scouting director in the history of the game. He built some of the great Blue Jay teams in the 90s and drafted Roy Halladay and Chris Carpenter in the first round. And actually, the way we did it back then is a little different than it is today, too, in the modern-day game. Tim was the one that actually should get the credit for drafting Javi Baez, not Jim Hendry. I did the contract, and I approved of Tim taking him. But Tim told me as early as April 1st, that he said, this is the guy I want. I just hope the people in the country don't end up liking him more than we do. I think we were picking like 9th or 10th, and that was Tim's guy all along. So, you know, I might have helped finish it off, but Tim was the one that actually was the one that wanted to pick Javi. Just like Oneri Fleta, our Latin American director, was the one that actually found Contreras in Venezuela. So it goes under the GM's watch. But to be very honest with you, those were the two guys that were the most responsible for them signing with the Cubs.
All right, so the final thought, just the concept of the Cubs going to Wrigley Field on Saturday or Friday and Saturday and Sunday for a World Series. What's it mean to you as a former general manager, a former employee of the Cubs organization?
Well, as a GM, I didn't grow up here, but the 8 years I worked for the Cubs before I became the GM, I got it better than most people that didn't grow up here. Wanted to help the Cubs franchise get to the World Series and win it for the generations that had done without and the great fans that we had all over the country. So for what happened the other night and winning the pennant and what's going to be like Friday night at Wrigley Field, it's such a credit to not only the organization now, but to all the people that have stuck with and loved the Cubs for, you know, a century. And it's so well-deserved. So I think my most pleasant thought is that all the people that spent their lives growing up there and their parents and grandparents went to Wrigley Field, they finally get what they deserve.
There you go. Jim Hendry, former Cubs GM, now with the New York Yankees. Mr. Hendry, thanks for taking some time out to talk to us tonight. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Anytime. Take care.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNradio.com. All right, coming up, we're going to talk with Joe Mantegna and Stuart Gordon. Great combination of guys who worked at the Organic Theater and brought us the famed play Bleacher Bums. So we'll talk about Cubs culture with Joe and Stuart coming up here on The Download. But first, let's get an update on tonight's news, an update on that World Series game. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, several Chicago celebrities are showing their love for the Cubbies, but not all the celebs have actually created art that pays homage to the fans. Of course, I'm talking about the Chicago play, the great Chicago play, Bleacher Bums, written in 1977 by the ensemble at the Organic Theater. It was a play about a ragtag bunch of Cubs fans who spent their days in the bleachers at Wrigley Field. The play ran for a few years and went to New York. It toured. It was broadcast on WTTW. We all remember it. The play was written and performed by some legendary Chicago talent, Dennis Franz, Stuart Gordon, who we'll talk to later this hour, and my next guest, the one and only Joe Mantegna. Mantegna is an award-winning actor, excelled on Broadway, in film, and in television, where he currently stars in the hit drama Criminal Minds. And he's a diehard Cubs fan who's thrown out several first pitches and sang many seventh-inning stretches. He's my guest tonight on The Download. Joe Mantegna, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So let's talk about, I mean, how it for you to think about this Bleacher Bums play that you guys put together at the Organic back in 1977 to where we're at now. First off, let me get your thoughts on you know, your energy and everything that goes into the Cubs making the World Series.
Well, I mean, you know, I conceived that play. I mean, if you look at the script, it'll say conceived by Joe Mantegna and written by myself along with the original cast, which is what we did. So it was like even back then, I mean, in 77, I used to go to the games as a young man and think, what is it about this team that has basically, you know, been somewhat over the course of at least my lifetime and most of my parents' lifetime, actually all of my mother's lifetime, who's now 101, they've been at best, you know, an average team, but yet draws this incredible crowd every week. And I kept thinking to myself every game, and I thought to myself, if I can get a capture in theater, that same feeling, what is it about fandom? If I could capture that in a play, then I've got a hit. And so when I broached that to our theater company back in 77, when we were looking for new ideas for new plays, I said, how about a play about the people in the bleachers? Come sit with me in my section and you'll see what I'm talking about. What is it about this diverse group of people who get together and root for basically a team that has never, you know, closed the deal for them and yet show up every game? And that was the genesis of Bleacher Bums. And so it was funny when the play opened, and it did do very well. It was hugely successful and has been for the last 39 years. But I remember when they interviewed me back then, they said, well, Joe, when your play, when the Cubs ultimately go to the World Series and win a World Championship, your play will become obsolete. What are you going to do about that? And I said, well, I'll cross that bridge when I come to it. Not knowing it would be hopefully 39 years
right,
later,
right.
And we're certainly closer than we have been, and so I'm just, as you can imagine, I'm just thrilled and excited, and I'd like nothing better than Bleacher Bums become it's a nostalgic look at the way the Cubs used to be.
You know? Well, I'm interested just in the concept of, you know, how, you know, when you thought of the idea, okay, I'm going to do something on the people I sit by in the bleachers.
Right.
Take us back to 1977. There was a little bit of national notoriety around the Bleacher Bums and the crazy group that would get together. Well, talk about what that experience was like and take us back to the bleachers back then.
Well, you know what was exciting about it for me? Because I would sit in this one section just to the right of center field, and it was such a diverse group of people. I mean, you had guys up there who would like to gamble on, you know, nothing serious, but gambling on every little thing, an out or an inning or a foul ball or who's going to score and stuff like that. But then you had kids up there. You had girls up there who were basically there to get a suntan. You had this one group, and there was three blind guys that would all come together. One would listen to the radio and kind of let the others know what was going on by the play-by-play. And I was taken by the diversity of it. I said, these are people that for this moment in time, while they're up here in the bleachers, they have this common interest, and they're all together, and there's this camaraderie. Yet when the game is over, they are going their separate ways, and they have nothing, absolutely nothing in common with each other. From the girl in the bikini to the businessman to the kid who's covered with frosty malts, to the blind guys, to the guy who comes in from left field from the crazy guys in left field that would, you know, started the whole throw the ball back and all that. That was our homage to the left field Bleacher Bums guys, to Ronnie Woo Woo. We had a character, you know, do a little bit like Ronnie does. So I was just taken by that whole, you know, what is this microcosm of people who share really very little in common except this love for this team. And yet when the game is over, they're going to come back and do the same thing all over again tomorrow.
Well,
and that's the way the bleachers were, and that's what I loved about it, and that's what I love about Cub fans in general, that it was just like that we have this one thing, that this thread that runs through all of us all over the world, and that hopefully that thread is about to be celebrated soon, you know.
Well, I mean, were you surprised as an actor in the time that the play was so successful, not just here in Chicago, but touring around the country, that It's been done so many different times in so many different theaters. Are you surprised that it sort of resonates past a baseball fan, a Chicago fan, a Bleacher fan?
Yeah, initially I kind of was, because I got to say, you know, we opened it in Los Angeles in 1980 as a waiver play. A few of us from the original cast, myself, Patrick Williams, and then a few people who actually did versions of it in Chicago after that, Vinny Gustafaro and Mike Sodd and Keith Serbica. But that show ran in Los Angeles for 10 years. It became one of the longest-running, what they call equity waiver shows, in Los Angeles theater history, from 1980 to 1990. And especially during that time, I thought to myself, well, it's not all Cub fans. We're coming to this play. And then it made me realize, well, it's that whole thing of rooting for the underdog. It's the whole thing of what fandom is about. And I'd hoped it was going to transcend just being about a single team. That it's about that whole thing of always, you know, never giving up for that one thing you believe in, even when it's, you know, the direst of times and the hardest thing to do, you know. And so I think it transcended that. And so fans of not just the Cubs, but just people who could relate to that concept of fandom, I think embraced it. And so the Cubs became kind of the symbol for that.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, and I don't want to spoil the play, but at the end, the Cubs lose. I mean, that's part of it.
The Cubs do lose. They lose to the Cardinals.
Yeah.
But well, the interesting thing in the play, if you look at the play, everybody comes in as an individual. They come in so singly into the play. But at the end of the play, everybody leaves in as a couple. You know, they make some sort of connection, and during the course of the play, it's kind of a fun, hopefully sentimental, sweet connection. Except for the one character, Marvin, who's the guy who wins. He's the guy who bets against the Cubs.
Right.
He bets on the Cardinals. But at the end of the play, you hear the announcer saying, "Come back tomorrow, you know, for another game with the Cubs and the Cardinals." And you see Marvin picking up the loose change up in the bleachers that people had dropped.
Yeah.
And he's by himself, and then you go, well, who really won here? Who won and who lost? The team lost, but the people left very optimistic. And Marvin's picking up the loose change, and yeah, he won some money, but he's by himself. So I mean, it was a little bit of a, you know, well, it's a play, but you know.
Yeah, Joe Montana, my guest. We're talking about Bleacher Bums. 39 years, obviously, we're talking about it because the Cubs make the World Series this week. It's World Series week here at 720 WGN. All right, so I'm interested because it's been, like I said, 39 years, and futility plays a big role in the play, this idea of the Cubs losing and the lovable losers and the whole bit. Is it the same concept in 1977 as we see in, I mean, even 2015, the concept that, you know, futility plays such a role in the psyche of the Cubs fan?
Well, I mean, I think it did. I think what happens is ultimately time, and the whole saying, time heals all wounds. And I thought it's like to say that 108 years is enough time.
Right.
You know, I mean, I was interviewed recently about, you know, the Cubs' recent success, and they wanted me to say a little blurb. And we have a restaurant here in California that my wife owns called Taste Chicago in Burbank, California. And, I mean, literally, it's a haven for all, you know, expatriate Chicagoans to go to. We have, the Italian beef and the deep dish and all the Vienna dogs. And, of course, we show all the Cubs and the Sox and the Bulls and the Blackhawks and the Bears and all the games. So I stood in front of Ernie Banks' jersey for this interview, and I basically said, my mother, and this is true, my mother turned 101 in September. She's waited long enough is what my comment was. But I think what's happened in those 108 years is it's almost like that whole thing of, like, you have to get rid of the generation. You have to get rid of the generation of the curse and of this and of that. You know, you got to bring in, you know, Ricketts and the Cubs and the current ball club, they really did it all right, you know, with Epstein and with Madden and the whole deal. In other words, they wiped the slate clean. They said, okay, we get it. There's this whole philosophy about the lovable losers. Well, that's over. That's done. We're resetting the odometer, you know? It's like you've gone past your expiration date for the curse. Let's move on.
Let's move on, right.
And that's what's great. And it just goes to show. And when we saw it happen in Boston, you know, when you saw it happen in Boston a few years back, and I remember when Boston won that first series, I remember the last line, and I think it was in the Boston Globe, that when they wrote the article about them the next day was, well, I guess the last thing we need to do is say, go Cubs, which was, I thought, was very kind of them and fitting, and hopefully that prophetic kind of saying will come true this week.
Well, for you, I mean, as a theater artist in 1977, writing a play about the Cubs, being a tremendous star in Hollywood and on Broadway, and always being a Cubs fan, a diehard Cubs fan from here in Chicago. What does it mean to you that the Cubs are in the World Series, that this is happening right now? What are the emotions that are happening with you, Joe Mantegna?
You know, it's hard to say because I've never had these emotions before. I mean, when I talk to other people, we all say, we all look at each other like, oh, my God. Like, I was at the restaurant Saturday night to watch the final four innings. I mean, I had to go to a memorial, actually, earlier in the day, so that's why I missed the first few innings of the game. But I got there for the last few innings, and our restaurant was, of course, jammed with Cub fans, and the place was going berserk. And, I mean, we were kind of like representing the West Coast, you know, fandom out here. And we were all looking at each other at the conclusion, and nobody even knew how to react. It was like, can you believe it? We're going to the World Series. We don't know even how do you comprehend that? I mean, my wife, she yells at me when I say, and I say it jokingly, I say, you know what? If the Cubs do win the World Series, maybe what we should all do collectively as a nation is dissolve baseball and start embracing soccer like the rest of the world. And maybe the rest of the world start treating us better. They'll start saying, oh, my God, they're embracing the beautiful game. You know, maybe they're not so bad after all.
I love it. The perfect. That's the idea. Joe Mantegna's got the right idea.
The Cubs winning the World Series could ensure world peace if everyone gets on board. But what are you going to do?
Joe Mantegna, of course, the man behind Bleacher Bums. He and his ensemble at the Organic Theater back in 1977 wrote the play Bleacher Bums, which has turned into television shows and to films and also has toured around the world. Joe Mantegna, thanks so much. Go Cubs, and we appreciate you taking some time out to talk to us tonight.
It was my pleasure. Thank you. Go Cubs indeed.
It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, we continue talking about the famed play Bleacher Bums, a 1977 gem that was on stage at the Organic Theater here in Chicago. It's conceived by Joe Mantegna, but the Organic Theater Ensemble also gets a writing credit, and the play also launched the career of director Stuart Gordon. Gordon went on to Hollywood to direct, write, and produce several films, including work on Reanimator, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Space Truckers, Body Snatchers, Robot Jocks, just to name a few. But for Chicagoans, nothing beats Bleacher Bums, which is about to celebrate its 40th anniversary. Hard to believe. Stuart Gordon, welcome to The Download.
It's great to be here.
So let's just talk. I mean, for you as a Cubs fan growing up in Chicago, being in a way a part of the celebrated culture around Wrigley Field, what's it mean that the Cubs are in the World Series?
Well, I feel like I'm in an alternate universe now. You know, I never thought I would live to see this day, but I am so grateful that I did.
It's interesting because, you know, thinking back to the Bleacher Bums, you know, I wonder how much, I mean, saying that's, you know, 40 years and we're going to celebrate a 40-year anniversary, how much of that play was rooted in the same sort of futility and the lore of not being able to win?
Well, you know, they do lose in Bleacher Bums.
Right.
And we got, took a lot of heat for that. But we said, look, we've got, you know, at the time, 40 years of history to back us up.
Right.
But, you know, and it ended up becoming, what, 71 years. But I'm so happy that we're obsolete now. You know, this new team has you know, started a whole new, you know, created a new world.
Well, you know, this was a famed show that was created by Ensemble. It was really sort of based on improvisation. Take us back to 1977. What was it about the Bleacher Bums and that experience around Wrigleyville, Wrigley Field? It wasn't even Wrigleyville at the time.
Wrigley Field did it.
Yeah,
we were doing theater not far away, you know, in a theater in Uptown. And, you know, every day on our way to the theater, we'd go by Wrigley Field and see these lines of people lining up to see this team that hadn't won, you know, a pennant, you know, in 40 years. And Joe Mantegna said, you know, we should really do a play about the fans. You know, if we could just get, you know, a fraction of them to come to see our show, you know, that would be fantastic. And he, you know, is a major Cub fan, and he knew this little group that hung out in the center field bleachers. And he took us all to see them, and it was an amazing group. It was primarily a group of guys who were gambling on just about anything that happened, every pitch, whether a pigeon would cross the first base line, I mean, anything. And there were also two blind guys who were play-by-play announcers. There was, the left field Bleacher Bums who would believe that the fans could influence the outcome of the game.
Right.
So we saw all of these amazing characters, and so we started showing up at the game with little tape recorders and recording their conversations, which we then would go back to the theater and use as the basis for improvisations.
For you, when Joe said, yeah, you got to check this out, I mean, were you skeptical that this would be enough for a play, that this would be something that would hold people's attention, the guys that go to every single day game at Wrigley Field?
Well, it's funny. When we first started out, our plan was that it was going to take place over an entire season, you know, and start out with all of the fans all bundled up, you know, in April and go all the way through the summer. But we finally decided it should just be one game. And it was that year, 77, the Cubs were doing incredibly well. It looked like they were going to make it. And then they pulled their, you know, sort of fold up and, you know, ended up in fourth place. And there was a line in the play, you know, there's a one of the gamblers says, hey, nobody ever went broke betting against the Cubs after the 4th of July. But, you know, that's all different now. That's all over.
Well, I mean, are you surprised? I mean, obviously, you know, up to this year, I mean, you could say a lot of the storylines, a lot of what happens in your play, Bleacher Bums, was accurate. I mean, it was continued to be accurate decade after decade.
I know, for 40 years. But one of the people we talked to when we were doing the play was Jack Brickhouse, who was the original Cubs announcer. And it always kills me that Harry Carey gets all the credit now. But Brickhouse was there twice as long as Carey. And, you know, he's the one who did, you know, his tagline was, you know, hey, hey, holy mackerel. And there was the song that the Cubs played at the end of every game was called Hey, Hey, Holy Mackerel, after Jack. And we went and talked to him, and he told us, you know, we said, do you have a dream? You know, and he said, well, my dream would be that the Cubs get into the World Series and that the White Sox get into it too.
Right.
And it's a Subway Series.
That would be something.
And it goes down to the, you know, final, you know, it's a tie game. It goes down into the extra innings, and in the 36th inning, they bring Ernie Banks out of retirement, and he hits a home run right into my lap.
Right. There
and
it
that
is.
That became the last sort of speech in Bleacher Bums.
That's right. That's right. We're talking with Stuart Gordon, the director of Bleacher Bums, the famed Bleacher Bums, which was at the Organic Theater here in Chicago, 1977, about to celebrate 40 years of this play. Joe Mantegna, Dennis Franz, other actors as well involved in this great theater company, Organic, that really was sort of the genesis of the off-loop theater scene here in Chicago. We're talking about it, of course, because the Cubs in the World Series, game one tonight. All right, so, you know, as you think about this, you know, this play, Bleacher Bums, isn't necessarily just about baseball. Baseball's the backdrop. It's really about the life, and it's about the love and you know, sort of the idea of the bleachers being a place. Do you see that? I mean, is that something that stays with the Cubs lore? It stays with this sort of idea that as people go to Wrigley Field this weekend for a World Series, that they all know the people that sit next to them, and they've been going to these games forever? Do you think that's a lost sort of
idea? I think when we were doing the play, I think it cost like $5 to go to the bleachers. You know, now it's something like 70, I think. And so it's a little pricier. But, there are the hardcore fans who are there every single game and sit in the same seats. I mean, one of the things in our play is, you know, the character that Joe Mantegna played had to sit in this particular spot in the bleachers. It was his good luck seat. And I think a lot of people still have that, you know, that still goes on. And the Bleacher Bums, I think, are still legendary.
For you, I mean, to think about it, you know, to as the Cubs go to the World Series here this week, and to think about that play being 40 years ago, I mean, what comes to mind for you? What is it that sort of, you know, the fact that the Bleacher Bums is part of the Cubs lore, as the play is as part of the Cubs lore as much as the Cubs themselves?
Well, the Cubs themselves, you know, never really, I mean, the Cubs management never warmed to the play because it showed them losing the game. But we had the Cubs players come to see the game, and that was always wonderful. And, you know, they appreciated it all. And, you know, the play is what it's about. It's about hope. You know, we had a bunch of Russian guys come to see it, you know, Russian artists, and they know nothing about baseball. But that's what they came away from saying. They said, this is about, it's not about baseball, it's about hope.
Right.
And I always thought that was exactly right. And that's why we were able to play it, you know, do the play in New York and other cities. And, you know, it's done all over the world now. And, that always makes me feel good.
For you, I mean, talk about being a Cubs fan and that concept of hope as we, you know, are talking to you right here on World Series week. I mean, what is it about being a Cubs fan and that idea of hope and spring and everything about the lovable losers and what's happening?
Well, you know, there's my old friend Stu Glickin, who unfortunately just passed away this year, you know, didn't get to see this, used to say that being a Cubs fan is like being a Jew. You're always waiting for the Messiah, you know. And so now he's shown up. And thank you, God.
So do you think now that with your with plans for a 40th anniversary, I mean, if there were any plans, I mean, does the Cubs making it to the World Series change anything about the lore of Bleacher Bums?
Well, it's funny. You know, I was talking to Dennis Paoli, who's one of the authors, and he said we should do the Bleacher Bums at the World Series. You know, that should be we should do a sequel.
There you go, right?
So who knows? Maybe we will.
Stuart Gordon, a longtime Hollywood director, film director. He's done so many different films. Got to start at the Organic Theater in Chicago, obviously directing the play Bleacher Bums, the ensemble written play at the Organic Theater, which is doing it in Uptown at the time in 1977. Stuart, congrats on the Cubs making it to the World Series.
Oh, yeah. Amen, brother.
And thanks for taking some time out to talk to us tonight. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, let's talk about one of my favorite places on Earth, Navy Pier. I had the good fortune to spend a good number of years working at Navy Pier. Well, the guys in studio with me now, Jeffrey Bear and Eddie Griffin, they are the guys that bring you all the great stuff at WTTW, from Walking the Lake to what we talked about last time, the south side of Chicago. They got a new special on Navy Pier. It's celebrating its 100th anniversary here in Chicago 2016. It's going to air on October 27th on Channel 11. Guys, good to see you. Welcome back.
Hey, Justin.
Great to be here.
It's like my favorite place and my favorite guests all together.
Oh, wow. Man. Well, this is our favorite place.
This is it.
Right here, WGN.
Why, let me ask, why Navy Pier? I mean, Navy Pier, of course, in its 100th anniversary, but what's so special about Navy Pier? You would want, one would say, it doesn't sort of add up to some of the other things that you've done with these projects.
I think it's one of probably a short list of places that everyone in Chicago knows about. You either go there all the time, or, as we found out, you know, there's a lot of history that people have very strong connections to. So it's something that everyone has a good baseline for.
Mm-hmm. It's only been a tourist destination, I guess, in the last
1995.
30 years. 1995.
Actually, so that's interesting. Were you being facetious when you said it's your favorite
No,
place?
I am being facetious, but it's okay.
No, I think that's really central to this whole project, which is that, like probably most real Chicagoans, I pretty much left Navy Pier to the tourists about 20 years ago. And so what's interesting is, you know, and so when I found out I was going to spend my whole summer at Navy Pier, you know, filming a documentary, you know, I thought, really?
Eating churros. Like,
yeah, exactly. But there's really kind of two sides to this. One is that the pier actually has a fascinating history. Like, it's just a great story, and we can get into talking about that. But the other thing is that the pier, in honor of this 100th anniversary, they've really tried to fix some of the sort of carnival-esque clutter.
Yeah.
And they've hired a really top-notch landscape architecture firm out of New York, James Corner Field Operations, which did the High Line in New York, which is, you know, brilliant. It's kind of like the Millennium Park of New York. And if you haven't been to Navy Pier in the last, say, 3 months, as I spent my whole summer there, it kind of won me over. It's really pretty amazing what's been done there.
What I love about – I've always loved about it. I mean, the carnival atmosphere and the tourist trap part of it is what I kind of joke about. But there are amazing moments of tranquility on Navy Pier, where you could go out to a different spot and be able to see a skyline in, you know, almost this beautiful, like, zen moment. Talk about what drew you guys to this project, because – you know, it's not always been that way. It's not like the regular Chicagoans could go out there 100 years ago and stand there and go, it had a different purpose, didn't it?
Well, actually, it was originally, so it opens in 1916, and it's like a dual facility for shipping, but also for recreation. I mean, you think of, like, what are people doing in 1916? Obviously, there's not a lot of technology, and your entertainment options are limited a little bit. So something like that, to just go out there and to sit and relax, you know, there's not a lot of air conditioning in public spaces, public venues. So you would just go out there and you would sit and relax. And then obviously they have theaters, and they had, you know, attractions for kids. There's a carousel, you know, talking early 1960s, beer garden. And you would just go out there and relax. And that's probably something that's that's really kind of the main attraction 100 years later.
When you talk about 100 years ago and you say part of it was actually for utility, for shipping, talk about that. I mean, what kind of shipping was coming through? Was it what we know as the Great Lakes being, you know, was this the destination for the port of Chicago?
Right. So the pier was part of the famous Burnham Plan, the 1909 plan that was going to take this crowded, filthy city and civilize it, turn it into sort of Paris on the prairie, give us a lakefront park system and a double-decker whacker drive and all that, and clear out all the docks and wharves along the river. But the city at that time, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, was one of the busiest ports in the world. There were thousands of canal barges and schooners jamming the river. And so part of the idea of Navy Pier was to get that trade kind of, you know, unclogged from the river and give shipping a big terminal on mm-hmm. the lakefront. Now, it turned out most of that shipping ended up going down to Calumet Harbor on the south side. But yes, I mean, part of the original plan, the idea was
to give the river a little relief.
Right. Mm-hmm. But the sort of story of the show and I think the kind of arc of it that Eddie really, I think, came up with early on was the pier has had sort of an identity crisis since it was created. It never really was a big shipping pier. And so like about every 20 years, we come up with a new idea of what to do with the pier.
Right. And it's always kind of been there for whatever the city needed. But it was never really – I mean, it was designed – we talked about the original intent was recreation and shipping. But everything after that, like, it wasn't really ever designed for something, but that didn't stop anyone. They moved it in anyway, and the University of Illinois Chicago starts there. Mm-hmm. That's not like what you think of like classroom facilities. That's not campus, but they made it work. So
yeah, well, if you want to go kind of over time, World War I breaks out, it becomes a training center, and there was also a jail there mm-hmm. for draft dodgers, and then after the war, it becomes this kind of big sort of place for expositions, big like the what was the big exposition in 1921?
The Pageant of Progress.
The Pageant of Progress, beauty pageants. You know, then it becomes a World War II breaks out. It becomes a World War II training facility, carriers.
That's where my grandpa was, right?
There you go. Yeah. And we interview, actually, you know, Hot Duggs?
Yeah.
We interview his father, Herb Sohn, was a young Navy recruit, and he's in the show.
He talks about, they had 3,000 sailors. You know, we're bunking in the barracks, you know, and again, never meant to handle that many people,
that, right.
But just shove them in there and you know, see what happens.
He said when he was told that he was going to be stationed there, someone advised him, get the middle bunk, because in the bottom bunk, the rats will bite your toes, and on the top bunk, the pigeons will poop on your head, so get the middle bunk.
Get the middle bunk. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's been a lot of things. I mean, you mentioned UIC, but it's also fallen on hard times. Sometimes along that, you know, it's nothing, or you know, I think of like the 70s as a time when Navy Pier really didn't do much for Chicago, and there were talks about maybe we don't need it.
It's absolutely insane to me that period, that was almost kind of abandoned. You think just like real estate, lakefront real estate now, like what, you would never let that go to waste, you know, and also compare it to Navy Pier, you know, that we know today. It's like, how could you let something like that sit for so long? And, you know, and granted, they tried and there were plans.
Well, that 70s era, though, Eddie, talk about, he got the most incredible footage of, well, I guess it wouldn't be the 70s. Chicago Fest would be the 80s.
But I was going to make a transition. It seems like in Chicago history, you can look at the resurgence, and even there was still some time after that, but it was Mayor Jane Byrne and the idea of bringing what we now know to be Taste of Chicago to Navy Pier.
See, he even thinks it's Mayor Byrne.
Wasn't Mayor Byrne?
No.
Was it Blandick?
It was Blandick.
Hey, Blandick. He doesn't get any credit, this
so
guy.
So Byrne
one
tried
snowstorm and everybody hates him, right?
So Mayor Blandick created Chicago Fest at the pier. The next year, Mayor Byrne tried to cancel Chicago Fest.
Oh, weird.
But the unions would not hear of it, the people. And so she rebranded it Mayor Byrne's Chicago
right.
Fest.
We've had a couple of those items on Swap Meet, which we do on Thursday, mm-hmm. where people still have posters from that.
Well, you will not believe, Eddie, talk about the footage that you got from Chicago Fest. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, we actually hooked up with some festival goers, and one who actually was a photographer back then had some incredible photos. But we happened to soundstage WTTW's concert series taped Cheap Trick in 1981 at the pier.
and they spent a whole day filming stuff. So we've got this incredible footage of, you know, 1980s.
He's in a green suit, like dancing around on the stage.
Oh yeah, Robin Zander. Yeah.
And the kids like rushing the gates. I mean, it's like you think like Who concert totally when you see these kids like rushing into
1981.
81, yeah. Wow. Chicago Fest was there till through 1982.
Yeah, it's such an interesting place. You know, as we fast forward to 1995, Mayor Daley really wanted to push it as a tourist destination, and it opened up. And it quickly emerged as the number one tourist destination for the city of Chicago. Why is that? I mean, there's so many things to do, whether you go up to the top of a skyscraper or go to the great parks in this town. What was it about a place like Navy Pier being, again, like we've been talking about, rebranded, that was able to grab so many people's attention?
Such a big space. There's just so much to do there. You go talk about Sears Tower. I mean, that's just kind of one thing to go up on Skydeck or, you know, to go up for the view. But out there, there's so many. There was, and there is so many different things that you could spend an entire day there. And I think probably what's really popular about it is you can spend an entire day there without paying any money.
you can. I mean, they try hard to make that not possible. But right. Yes.
Well, Burnham called it the People's – Daniel Burnham, who envisioned it in 1909, called it the People's Pier. And, you know, it is lowbrow, or it was. I mean, there's no question about that. You know, the tchotchke stands and the, you know, squash a penny and ride the Ferris wheel. But, you know, it's for the people. But I think the thing that – I came to, and I think we kind of worked on how to talk about the appeal of it for our sort of big finish to the show. And I think the thing that I came to after my summer there is that the rest of Chicago's lakefront, thanks to Daniel Burnham, is a park. It's a public park. We don't have a great commercial waterfront in this city like they do in New York or San Francisco or other great waterfront cities. The one and only place in Chicago where you can have both these beautiful views, unbelievable views of the skyline and smell the lake breezes and feel the wind and all that, and also, you know, get a burrito, you know, and a Beanie Baby.
And a beer,
and you can walk around with a beer.
Right.
Is it Navy Pier? And so it's kind of this. It sort of, whereas the rest of if we had a big commercial waterfront, it would sort of be spread out all across the lakefront. But this is concentrated in one spot. And I do want to repeat that the way this new redo of Navy Pier has happened, they've decluttered it. They've opened up the views. And there were many evenings. You go out there in the evening. There were many evenings when we just walked out there.
It's amazing.
The lighting that they've got, they've uplit the trees and the benches are lit. And it's beautiful. The water's reflecting the lights of the city and the moon. And it's really a different place.
I will say this. Like the one thing, for as many years that I spent at Navy Pier, being out there for the coldest of the cold days when you had to go out and it was snowing, but it was negative 10, you had to go to work. And seeing the lake that close up with Navy Pier, and it's almost like shimmering and smoking at the same time, was something that I'll never forget. Navy Pier, a tremendous amount of history. Even if you go further back, and you know what, you should explore it at some time. If you even go further back to the Grand Ballroom and all the places in the back, there's some great history, and the unofficial historians of Chicago, Jeffrey Baron, Eddie Griffin, do it for you, and they will have their special on Thursday, October 27th on WTTW Channel 11. Eddie, good to see you. Jeffrey, thanks for being here, and thanks for giving us another tour to celebrate.
Absolutely.
Great.
Thank you,
here.
Justin.
Thanks.
Thank you, Rob. It's Download Here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 tonight when the post game begins. We'll be on with Andy Mazur, Adam Hoge, Mark Carmen. Take a look at tonight's Game 1 of the World Series. It's interesting, you know, I think one of the areas that we'll focus on to begin is, and the game's still, there's still plenty of time here, not plenty, but they're in the eighth inning. But the top of the order, Fowler, Bryant, and Rizzo, 0-for.
Nothing.
And that's going to be, I mean, you know, it was only, it's such a fickle game.
I know.
And it was just like so, I mean, we were just having this conversation midweek last week about the bats falling asleep at the wrong and inopportune times, and good pitching will do that to you, so that's what we're seeing.
Yeah, it's just amazing how things turn around. I mean, yeah, whatever, they lost that game against the Dodgers, and they were like, yeah, the Cubs, they're done. They're toast.
We were all...
I mean, really. And even like following Twitter tonight, like it's like I'm so angry. People are like, I'm so angry right now. I'm like, hey, guy, it's the first game. This pitcher Kluber looked like he was pitching lights out. Like his ball was moving. Like,
well, I mean,
it
he
was
had
like
nine,
a wiffle ball.
Yeah, he had nine strikeouts. Probably could have, you know, shutout ball. It's an interesting strategy, and I think that baseball's changing this way. The Cubs don't necessarily do it this way, but the Indians picked up Andrew Miller, who's on the mound. You know, he was sort of a setup closer guy for the Yankees, him and Aroldis Chapman. But it's interesting that they, not unlike what the Dodgers did with Kenley Jansen, a little different in the way that Jansen was the closer. They still have a closer. Cody Allen could come in at any moment. But they've gone to this role that there are going to be, Andrew Miller's going to be in every game. We need to get to a certain inning with the lead and just give him the ball. Which is, the Cubs don't do with that. There's not a necessary guy that's going to come in for 2.5-3 innings that, you know, you go to and you can count to see that person. It just almost feels, in a weird way, and I'm sure it probably statistically works out, but it almost has like a very, I don't know, desperate feel to it. I felt that with Kenley Jansen too, where you're like the Dodgers closer, where he's in the game in the seventh. You're like, that's pretty desperate that you're this like tight that you can't go to a setup guy, you can't go to a middle reliever or whatever it is.
Yeah, I think in the NLCS, the game six, I think he came in the sixth. Yeah, it's certainly different the way they handle that. But I mean, yeah, I mean, Mike, you know, depending on who they have for pitchers, I mean, the matchups. You know, I know Mike Montgomery is, you know, during the Dodgers, a left-handed laden lineup. They had him in for a couple of innings, but yeah, it's no longer take your. I have to say, when Madden took Hendricks out in that game, with you know he was pitching a gem, had like one hit, and then they were going to bring in Chapman in the eighth inning, and I was like, oh, what is he? I put my head down. I'm like, no, like what's he doing? And then he had like two pitches and a double play. So
is a turn of events for the Cubs and the Indians. And the top of the eighth inning, there are two outs, runners on first and third. After a big hit for Ben Zobrist, two hits tonight.
Or as Pete Rose calls him, Ben Zobrist.
Zobrist. Let me show you how to hit. Let me show you my batting stance. What's the over-under on this at-bat? Now Andrew Miller will face, the left-hander will face Kyle Schwarber, and that's why he's in the game. You know, Kyle Schwarber will bat with runners on, two runners on, a swing of the bat, and we're talking about a tie game. But we're not going to do
great.
That.
We hear Vin Scully call this the hobbled guy comes out and hits a home run in the first game of the World Series to turn things around.
Great, wasn't it? So last night I went with David Hochberg, famed David Hochberg.
The David Hochberg.
We went to the Hawks game together. Yeah, had a great time with him. I had a great time watching a Blackhawks game. They lost to the Flames. With a guy who knows hockey better than me. I mean, it was just amazing to sit there. I felt like it was a two-hour interview. Like, that's why I have a cold, and you can tell I'm a little hoarse, but I think it had a lot to do with me going, so what are we experiencing now, David? There's a lot of, tell me, what does this ticket get me? I get in the door, okay, great. What is it? Oh, they're giving away free posters.
You got a free poster?
Yeah, but I lost it somewhere along the line. So, but you know, I have to say, you know, I've been to probably a handful of hockey games in my life, Blackhawks games. You know, it's just something that I've never really had experience in my post life, where you know there's tickets and you can go to the United Center to watch the game. So, this is the first time I'd ever watched a Blackhawks shootout. The Blackhawks lost last night in a shootout to Calgary Flames. But I had never seen that experience in the stadium. I'd never been in the United Center when there's an actual shootout. And there was something where I'm like, this is the best moment in sport. Like, across the board, and you're like two people. Like, there's a goalie and, you know, a hockey player, like a wing.
A score, yeah.
A score. And it's just, that's it, on the ice. And there's 21,000 people going,
And all the players are on the bench, like, standing up, hitting the side.
I was thinking in group sports, if there's anything like it. Kyle Schwarber with the strikeout. If there's anything like it in sports. Like, I mean, in basketball, I guess the free throw, but that's still a team thing where guys are around him. Maybe I can't think of a situation in baseball where two players would take over a game. Football, you just don't see. That's just not a thing. So it's just amazing to me that that's how they end games in this way that is so almost primitive in the way that it's just like one guy, one goalie, go get it.
Yeah,
I was impressed. That was a sporting moment. I was like, "Wow, this is pretty great."
Did David know it? Because the shootouts are recent. Isn't this a recent development? Like over the past
changed,
10 years?
Yeah, and they changed overtime to where now it's 3-on-3, and then you know. And I thought this was really interesting too. The Hawks, Calgary got a holding penalty, and you know gave the Hawks a power play in the OT when it was 3-on-3. But instead of going to 3-on-2, which I guess is just now you're getting crazy, they bring a 4-on.
Four
so now
and three.
It's 4-on-3. Like you get an extra
that makes
guy.
Sense,
I guess I was like, but I don't understand. I mean, I guess it makes sense. And then it got confusing because when the power play, it was the Flames killed it. And so then they were in this position where it's 4-on-4 because it doesn't go back to 3-on-3 to the whistle. So you're like, what's happening? I don't know what's happening. Hockey players flying in whichever way. And I wasn't the only one. I felt like at least in the section we were at, there was a lot of questions. Like, what's that? Why are there 4 on the – and then it was a shootout. But they went like 6 deep on the shootout.
Yeah, that's fun.
Yeah, and Christopher Stieg was the former Blackhawk, the rapper. Was the man who put the puck in the goal for the Flames. And then there was this moment where they were going to challenge it. Or I don't know what they were going to do, and – Taves and the Blackhawks wouldn't leave the ice. It was a nice little end to a game.
Wow, exciting.
Yeah, it's very exciting. So thank you, David. But it was fun. It was fun to not only be at a game, but to sit with somebody who knows a lot about the history of the team. And so it's kind of fun.
He had some nice seats.
Yeah. He's got nice, like it's, I don't know, the section.
Club level or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's.
You know, treated nice.
It was nice all the way around. You treated nice. Yeah, you know, if I were in the 300 section, they don't treat you nice. But 200, no, they treat the whole thing. It's a top-notch operation. But he was telling me, too, I was asking about the new stadiums for, you know, the United Center is somewhat old now. I mean, you think about it, it's 1993 or 1994, whatever they did that stadium. Maybe a little later, 95. But but it's interesting, it's 20 years old. They said now that they're building stadiums for basketball and hockey more gladiator style, like the old Chicago Stadium, where it's up, you know, and you kind of lean over it, so you're almost closer to the action opposed to out. And I think that that'd be fun to go to a stadium like that. I don't know if there's any, maybe the DePaul Stadium down by McCormick Place. Maybe that'll be in that style. Something tells me it won't, though. Something tells me it'll be very U.S. Cellular 1993, where you're like, what? This is a lot of concrete. You know what I mean? Like, there's not going to be any, like, the technological advances of the DePaul Stadium. No, it's going to be the Rosemont Horizon 2. World Series coverage. Count on your Cubs TV station, WGN, for more complete news and sports coverage throughout the series. Watch WGN-TV for everything Cubs this October. Speaking of Cubs, we continue World Series week here on WGN. Tomorrow night on the download, this is so exciting. It's so exciting that some great, tremendous Cubs fans who are the titans of their industry are willing to talk about their fandom and about this World Series. Tomorrow night on the program, Bob Newhart. Bob Newhart will join us to talk about, obviously he's become just sort of like a viral hit. Sensation of his grandkids making the W, the handmade W sign after Saturday's win. So Bob Newhart will join us tomorrow night to talk about what this week in this World Series means to him. Also from the hit, I sound like such an American Bandstand guy. Also from the hit band Fallout Boy, Pete Wentz is going to join us from the hit band, from the top 40 sensation, Fallout Boy. No, Pete Wentz will join us as well. And, you know, I'm excited to talk to him because it's also this idea that, you know, whenever we're talking to celebrities and other people, we get this vibe that's like a different, like even a little bit with Joe Mantegna tonight. And I'm sure with Bob tomorrow, Bob Newhart, you know, a little bit like it's been so long. But it'd be great to talk to some 20-somethings and 30-somethings about the idea of being a Cubs fan and what it means to be a Cubs fan. Pete Wentz from Chicago, Fallout Boy from here. We'll talk with Pete tomorrow on the program. Also this week, Walter Jacobson's going to join us, talk about his actual amazing story with the Cubs. He was, and a lot of people know this, but he was a bat boy with the Cubs. That's sort of what Walter Jacobson started his life as a bat boy for the Cubs. So we'll talk with Walter about his thoughts.
It wasn't the 1908 World Series, though.
It's like, that should be my first question to him. Take us back to 1908, Walter. What?
I love him.
Great. Also, this week is really great. Horatio Sanz, the former SNL cast member. Joe Nunez, also a Chicago improviser and movie actor, will be with us on Thursday as well. And Jerry Pritikin, the bleacher preacher, one of the original bleacher bums that Joe Mantegna and Stuart Gordon were talking about tonight, will join us as well. So a lot to do this week. I'm so excited. Like, it's so great. And there's more. I mean, those are just confirmed people. Pete and I have been busy. Like, it's so fun. Like, we're going deep. These are deep cuts. Like, we're going after guys who played on the Cubs, like, in late 70s. They're like, you want to talk to me about what? Me? You sure you got the right number? There's a lot of that. There's a lot of, Arkansas Mudheads organization. Yeah, is this the Arkansas? It's like, is Manny Trio, is he your hitting coach? Yeah, you want to talk to Manny? Yeah, is there any way to talk to Manny about what it's like to play in Chicago? That's really what it feels like, isn't it? That's like all of our conversations. Yeah, no, I'm looking for Vance Law. Is this not the Vance Law that lives on Spectre Street? Okay. All right. Well, you know what? Sorry about that. Played on the 89 Cubs. All right. So getting back to Blackhawks, why don't we do this now? We got the on-air giveaways, the 4 tickets to the Chicago Blackhawks Skate by the Lake ice rink at Navy Pier. You can enjoy outdoor ice skating at Navy Pier. And on this Saturday, October 29th, from 11 to noon, they're hosting a Youth Shoot the Puck contest. The contest is open to fans ages 8 to 13. And one lucky winner will win 4 tickets to an upcoming Blackhawks game and have the opportunity to shoot the puck in front of a sold-out United Center crowd. Registration opens at 10. Slots are limited. Visit ChicagoBlackhawks.com for more info. You know what? Let's give a pair of tickets, 2 pairs of tickets. There's 4 tickets available for the 10th and 11th caller tonight. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 312-981-7200. If you're the 10th and 11th caller, you will get the tickets for the Chicago Blackhawks Skate by the Lake ice rink at Navy Pier this Saturday, October 29th. So it's 312-981-7200, 10th and 11th callers. The package, I believe it's 2 packs, 4 tickets each. That's awesome. Get to go down to the Navy Pier that Jeffrey Bear was just talking about. While you're there, you go in the back and check out the architecture. Moving right along, moving down the pier. Do do do, little violin type, you know, like klezmer music. Do do do. Back in 1863, I could do a good Jeffrey Bear. Moving right along. Yeah, that's about it. That's all I got. That's pretty good, right? It's all in the rejoiners. It's the confidence in your rejoiners. A lot of people say, you know, this view right here is a view that you can't see anywhere else in the city. That's true. And that's all I got. That's all I got. So I got to work on it. I get put on the spot. It's like moving right along. Now, as we walk down the river, as we walk down the pier, that kind of thing. All right, 312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get the update on the game, the news, and then coming up after 10:30, we should be joined by Carm, Andy Mazur, Adam Hoge for True Blue Playoff Plus, of course, at the end of the game. So stay with us. All right, it's the late inning pitching changes that we love so much about Major League Baseball.
Bob is called to the dugout, brought to you by Steamy's Red Hots. I just made that up.
I love that the Cleveland Stadium's the overhead. They're so close. Like where the Indians play is like, I mean, essentially right next door to where the Cavs play.
Is that the, what is that, the Quicken Loans Arena?
Yeah, the only reason I know that is because it had like a huge ad for the sole purpose of that overhead shot. Like, yeah. We need to put a .com on here.
Well, they raised the banner over there.
That's true.
Championship tonight.
Esmeralda, quickly, you know, we had a issue today the issue with Picnic, of course, you know, our regular segment where we gave each and every member of the Chicago Cubs a nickname. One player that we did not bother with because they were on injured reserve was Kyle Schwarber. He did not make the cut. And then, of course, they embarrass us with a World Series sort of activation, and he's in the lineup tonight. So each one of our players has a tremendous nickname except for Schwarber. And Joe Maddon calls him Schwarbs.
Well, if you look him up on Google, his little, you know how they do that little bio to the side? He's apparently Kyle Daddy Joseph Schwarber. So I don't know who put that up there. But
wow.
If you want to use that one.
That could be his nickname. Maybe that's a nickname that he, from all these, maybe you get it from the club circuit here.
Oh, it's according to Wikipedia. Yeah. So.
Oh, I don't know if I'm Mark Carmen and I'm in the locker room afterward.
Daddy.
So, Daddy.
I mean, they got Poppy, Big Poppy for
Big Poppy. Yeah. Daddy, what were you thinking on that seventh inning at bat, Daddy? Come on, man.
Are you calling Daddy, you freak?
That's like, yeah, someone that's so good. I think it just sticks. I think we call him Daddy. Daddy with the double. Way to go, Daddy. That's so weird. Oh, all right. All this history calls to me. My God, it's been so long. Well, the Cubs tonight run into the Cleveland Indians, the hot Cleveland Indians, who have a 6-0 lead here in the going into the ninth inning. We're about to start the True Blue postgame, True Blue playoff plus. Mark Carmen, Andy Mazur are going to be in studio, Adam Hogue as well. Kev Powell's out in Cleveland. We'll get all that stuff ready to rock. It's probably start a little bit early as the guys come in studio now to set up shop. I got to say, a tough showing. You don't usually want to see games that are at this level where you have sort of essentially blowouts, six runs, a shutout being thrown by Kluber, Miller, and looks like it's going to be Allen as well. Andy Mazur, Adam Hogue, Mark Carmen, how are you guys? Good to see you.
I'm doing okay. Carmen, I think we're going to have to put into some kind of a straitjacket. It's one game against a guy that won an American League Cy Young Award.
You know what happened tonight, Justin? If you have to still go back to 1945 for the last time the Cubs scored in the World Series.
I told him I was going to punch him in the head on the air if he says that again.
I have a feeling, though, there's still a top of the ninth. Someone might change that, get at least one run up on the scoreboard.
They're fine.
All right, so let's talk about this. You know, game one tonight, the World Series, a lot of expectations in Chicago, obviously. I mean, the national media... the hype surrounding both of these teams, but the Cubs, namely, they came out kind of flat. Corey Kluber had a lot to do with that.
Look, you had two pitchers on the hill tonight that you kind of knew were going to have to be perfect, and the one that wasn't perfect wasn't going to get the win. And John Lester wasn't horrible tonight, but he struggled early. The Indians got their two runs off him early on, and I said at the time, this game might be over. It might be, because Corey Kluber's that good, and the guy they got coming in after him, Andrew Miller, is probably even better in terms of pure stuff.
Yeah, they looked better against him. I mean, they had some opportunities. And again, it was I had a lot of people asking me on Twitter about the way the seventh inning went down, about you know, the fact that David Ross was allowed to hit for himself. And again, probably a spot normally would be maybe for Soler, but gosh, I got to think that he is way down on the food chain as far as Joe Maddon is looking around the dugout going, okay, let's go with you.
Plus, that guy's come up with some big hits for you.
Yeah, Ross has.
The reality is that Lester had two outs,
nobody
on in the first inning. Francisco Lindor, who looks like he's going to be a monster in the series, gets a base hit. They run on him exactly like they said they were going to. It seemed like it rattled Lester from that point.
Yeah, I was going to ask you guys about that. I mean, the one thing that I really saw in that first inning was not just running on him, But the idea of these huge leads, mm-hmm. the first and second, is, and even you saw, I think it was Napoli or one of, when they got on, they were really kind of toying with John Lester, and it seemed to affect him as he started to walk. He was behind in the count. He wasn't the same John Lester that we've seen so far in the playoffs.
Well, I mean, there was one play, right, where Lindor was halfway to second.
Yeah, and went back to first.
Lester just, he stepped off. So I mean, listen, he's been in this position before where people have tried to rattle him, mm-hmm. and he's come through. I don't know if that happened or not. I think he actually was rattled for sure, or at least had beef, which was obvious because he was screaming at him.
That's where I think he was. That's where I think he lost it.
Larry Vanover, the home plate umpire, and him were not seeing eye to eye. And I was screaming at Larry Vanover too. But Larry Vanover, I don't think he was wrong. Not very many times. He wasn't awful.
He's been pretty bad for both teams tonight.
I mean, he was,
I thought he was consistent.
Consistently bad.
Maybe you call it consistently bad. That pitch to Bryant early on was probably a ball, but it was close enough that mm-hmm. it's one you can't be too mad about for taking. Got to protect on two strikes.
I mean, it was a great pitch. Dotted the very, very, yeah. very low outside corner.
Obviously, Kluber, like you said, a Cy Young Award winner in recent years. He's had a great season. He's also been hittable as a White Sox guy. I know that Corey Kluber can give up big yeah. games. But talk about the top three guys. I mean, there was this great stat on Saturday night of when Dexter Fowler gets on base, the Cubs win.
They're amazing.
Dexter Fowler, Chris Bryant, and Anthony Rizzo shutout tonight.
Yeah. You know, right now the only guy that got on base was Bryant in the eighth inning with a walk, and that's it. So, yeah, this is a very top-heavy team. I mean, you need to rely on those three guys to consistently get on base. The one guy we're forgetting to talk about tonight is Babe Schwarber, who almost hit a home run tonight. If it wasn't for the prevailing wind off of Lake Erie,
I think he proved that it was the right decision.
Yeah, I think
he did
right.
great at bat against Miller too.
Except he forgot how to run the bases all in the entire year. Should have been thrown out at second base. But,
yeah, that was a horrible
yeah,
play.
But lucky that he wasn't, but it was just amazing to watch him come up there. You know, that first time was kind of ugly, but I think you may have expected that after a long layover or layoff. But then they go to Pete Rose in his infinite wisdom, who says, yes, he's going to strike out three times tonight.
Yep.
Guess
and
what,
even Pete? And even John Smoltz was like, yeah, this is a tough position to put him in tonight.
I hope he didn't take that one to the window.
Yeah. Next pitch. Boom, off the wall.
Well, you know, it's in the ninth right now. Cubs are down 6-0, and Wilson Contreras just thought he hit one out to right field. He flipped the bat, ends up going off the wall, maybe even not even halfway up the wall, as we're looking at the replay right now, maybe halfway up the wall, regardless. It's just not your night. The guy was up with the bases loaded in the seventh. He does that right there.
Yeah.
We have a tie game.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, when they finally got something going in the seventh inning, you saw some of the same sort of, I guess, the problems that we saw in the NLCS that got covered up with a strong ending to that mm-hmm. series, where Wilson Contreras with a very meek fly ball with the bases loaded did not be able to score the run. Addison Russell, terrible at bat. Where yeah. I don't even yep. know, he just was waving at the ball.
He just looked over it, man.
And it just did. it felt once again that the Cubs were in that situation where they weren't being able to either make the play when they needed to make the play in the clutch situation.
And that's what it comes down to. And I guess the whole thing on the social media was all over that seventh inning about pinch hitting and this, that, and the other.
I just got to give it to the other guy for coming up big.
I think so, too. Made a good pitch.
Both teams can't come up big at the same time.
Nope.
One guy's going to win, one guy's going to lose. And Andrew Miller was just filthy. You know, he came in, he walked Schwarber. It was a great at-bat by Schwarber. After that long layoff, I can't believe the guy was even able to draw a walk in that situation. It was very impressive. Then Baez gets the single. Mm-hmm. And you're going
strikes.
Bases loaded, nobody out, and I don't care who you're facing, you got to get a run in that situation. But if there's any scenario there where you can come away from it and go, man, that guy was just so good, it's this situation. I mean, Andrew Miller was just lights out, and the only problem I had at all was that the last pitch to Ross, which was a full count, two outs. If you take it, you'll walk. I'm thinking you shorten up your strike zone a little mm-hmm. bit there, and the one he swung at on the 3-2 pitch was even farther inside than most. Yeah. That one was probably one that even on a filthy Andrew Miller pitch, you probably should have laid off it.
The only good thing about Andrew Miller's outing, for the Cubs' sake, is that he threw upwards of 40 pitches.
Right.
So you wonder about, I mean, the guy's got a rubber arm. He's a young kid. But
through 46 pitches. Yeah,
and you get the feeling that's the Indian strategy. They're just going to pitch Andrew Miller every time they get to the sixth.
They want to go three
inning.
Pitchers. Yeah. That's all they want to use. They want to use the guy they have in now.
Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back, and we'll keep up here. True Blue Playoff Plus brought to you by Wintrust, home of Cubs checking, and also Sloan Water connects us. We've got Andy Mazur, Mark Harmon, Adam Hoge in studio. We'll be back right after this, 720 WGN. All right, welcome back to True Blue Playoff Plus, brought to you by Wintrust, home of Cubs checking, also Sloan Water connects us. The Chicago Cubs lose game one of the World Series to the Cleveland Indians, 6-0. In studio with me right now, Adam Hoge, Andy Mazur, Mark Harmon. Very interesting night. I don't want to start right at the top. When we get into what you guys thought of the lineup, what you thought of Joe Maddon's strategy, Chris Coughlin obviously playing right field instead of Jason Hayward. Just overall, what'd you think of what the Cubs offered up with the lineup in game one?
I wanted Wilson Contreras to be in the lineup and play left field and have Ben Zobrist in right. That's what I wanted to see happen, and I was surprised that Kyle Schwarber was hitting fifth. I thought he'd obviously be in the lineup, but I thought he would hit seventh, something like that. Kyle Schwarber was great tonight, 1-for-3 with a walk. The walk was an incredibly impressive at bat against a lefty. Hits one off, it's a double off the wall when nobody could touch Corey Kluber. So Joe Maddon and company, clearly that was the right decision. Coughlin was 0-for-2 with a couple of strikeouts.
Yeah, that's where I would have changed.
I don't think that Chris Coughlin's going to get another opportunity to start a game in the series. I'd be shocked.
I don't really have a problem with it, though. I mean,
it's better than Hayward.
Right. The key for me was
crazy you're saying that,
getting Hayward out of there.
It really is.
I think the thing is Maddon likes having one of these young bats to put in, and I don't think you can rely on Jorge Soler right now to come in and pinch hit in a big moment. So with the added DH, you either would have lost Contreras, assuming Schwarber wasn't going to play at all. You were going to lose Contreras anyway, probably, off your bench. So with Schwarber coming back, I think he wanted to keep Contreras on the bench to have a big moment like he did in this game when he came up against Andrew Miller. Unfortunately, it just didn't work out.
Now, for me, I would have liked to have seen Almora playing in right field with Zobrist in left. Only reason being, I would have liked to have seen him bat ninth, because that way it gives you another guy to turn the lineup over. It's an American League game. You know, I mean, you want to have some speed at the bottom as well. I would have moved David Ross up to eight, but again, hindsight being 20-20, that's... That's how I'm not a big Coughlin guy. I don't really. He doesn't do much for me.
Let's be honest. It wouldn't have made a difference tonight.
No, definitely not tonight.
Do you chalk tonight up just the fact that you ran into the buzzsaw that is Corey Kluber, or do you say that some of this is nerves for a young team playing in a World Series?
I put it mostly on Kluber.
Yeah, it's like a Clayton Kershaw game again.
The dude was incredible.
And look, they want to pitch him three times.
Yeah,
which is terrifying.
Good luck.
It is, but are they going to win? You can't win four games with him only pitching three times.
He can't win.
You know?
He can't win.
You can't. I guess, let me rephrase that. He can't win four games in the series. He can only win three.
But let's say he does win three, then all they got to do is get one win out of Bauer, Tomlin, Santana, whoever.
Advantage Cubs in all those games, in my opinion.
Yes, but then there's always, it's baseball. Things happen. I don't know. Listen, this is going to be a tough series. That's the bottom line. You got that guy going three times. You got Andrew Miller coming out of the pen. You got Cody Allen coming out of the pen. This team's lost one game in the entire postseason. This is a formidable opponent, man. And they're hot at the plate. Yeah. This is going to be an incredibly tough series.
What struck me about the young guys on Cleveland was a lot of confidence against John Lester. I mean, they came out. They were squeaking little hits down the side. And when they got on base, they were taunting him, like we said, like sort of playing with him on the base pass, stealing bases on Ross. I mean, it seemed like a team that had a chip on their shoulder.
Well, and, you know, Terry Francona used to manage John Lester in Boston. They won a couple, you know, they won some titles together. So there's a manager in the other dugout that's got a pretty good idea of what the game plan is for the left-hander on the mound. But, you know, that being said, he's a veteran guy. I think he just kind of came unglued a little bit. Was not a normal John Lester kind of a bulldog-type performance. I mean, yeah, he settled down, and it was effective late in the outing, but it was – when you give a team a little bit of a glimmer of hope,
first
no matter
inning,
what if it is,
right,
the swinging bunt down the third baseline or a hit by pitch, I mean, it gives a team life, and you don't really need to give the Indians any more momentum. You know, like Mark was saying, you know, you've got these guys that are playing very well coming into this series. They've played a couple of very good teams in the Red Sox and the Blue Jays. So, I mean, that's – you don't want to give it to them.
I mean, hitting the batter with the bases loaded, that's the kind of stuff that one run difference changes the way that – even Wilson Contreras comes up in that situation with the bases loaded.
Mm, gets
it's,
hit.
Not, it's a three-run game, not a yeah. one-run game. And that's a yeah. that's a huge move, and that's solely on John Lester.
Yeah, and their number nine hitter, for some reason, killed the Cubs tonight. Well, I mean, you can't be giving up home runs to a catcher who, what are you saying, the regular season had three home runs?
Yeah, now he's got three in the postseason, two of them tonight.
Roberto Perez is the guy's
name. Like around 200, too. Yep. It was not
less.
A yeah, less.
I think it was a 176 somewhere. Come on. Double-check that. But he had a – I mean, the one-off Rondon is still going. That guy might not get in another game.
I was
going
to ask you. I thought about you when we did. Like that was a concern of yours, even all the way back to the Giants series. What's Hector Rondon going to give you? Do you want him in the game at all? Eighth inning, even with a lead. This was without a lead. He just looked like he just hung that ball.
Yeah, he did. And the pitches before that were up in the zone too.
Mm-hmm.
The one positive on that eighth inning situation, Pedro Strop came out of the pen, looked decent. The slider or curveball, whatever that thing was.
Looks good.
It looked good.
Yeah. Do you see any situation where Joe Maddon may have said, you know, conceded this game in the way that he had Justin Grimm, and then he went to Rondon? I mean, why not go with Montgomery or Edwards or the guys who got you there?
You had the first two outs in the eighth inning. It's still 3-0 game. Yeah. This team has shown the ability throughout the playoffs to come back in situations, including tonight. I mean, you had the chances. You had the chances tonight late in the game, granted against Andrew Miller, but you got two hits and two walks off Andrew Miller, and you didn't score. That's hard to swallow.
Well, they had the bases loaded, nobody out too. I mean, let's not minimize that. You just made an interesting point, Justin, that I hadn't thought about C.J. Edwards. This is a guy that had a little hamstring tweaky.
He said he was healthy today, but he didn't seem to have a lot of confidence to bring him in a situation.
But he's also a guy that they use more when they have the lead than they are when they're down.
Maybe so.
But that might have something to do with it. Plus, it was 45 degrees out there tonight, too.
I mean, that's fair, too. But in the playoffs, you don't really think about lead, not lead.
You do want to save some guys in case your bats start to wake up a little bit, and you've got guys that you've consistently all year been using when you're either tied or in the lead. There's a different mindset, and guys kind of understand their roles on this team. You know, Montgomery's been a guy that has been the gap between the starter and the deeper parts of the bullpen. You don't want to use. I don't think you wanted to use him tonight. I just, I thought maybe Travis Wood would go a couple more batters, but
just
me.
I'm watching the highlights as we're talking right here, and
do that to yourself.
I'm watching Schwarber hit bombs off the right field wall. I mean, this guy,
isn't that a huge positive tonight?
Yeah,
I guess if you're gonna look for positive,
he looked good.
That. Kyle Schwarber,
he looked great. I mean, he really did. The guy's up there with all this confidence and just staring out at the pitcher, like doesn't even blink, and he rips one off the wall. He's going deep into counts. That was a phenomenal performance by Kyle Schwarber.
Hitters hit, you know what I mean? I mean, it doesn't go away even if you've been gone. Yeah, you've been facing a machine that's not wearing a jersey and not wearing, spinning stuff up there, but this guy's got a great idea.
It had to help him, too, that he was in the dugout the entire year.
Yeah.
Being around this team, they had a lot of confidence in him just because of his personality. This is True Blue Playoff Plus, brought to you by Wintrust, home of Cubs checking, Sloan Water connects us. All right, we'll continue with the postgame in just a moment. We'll take a break, come back, get some highlights from Rob Martyr, and also we're waiting on Joe Maddon for his press conference after the game here on 720 WGN. Stay with us.